doctors, but they can't.
He's fragile. Very fragile.
Interracial John with Drew and Leslie. Get the shit on. Interracial John. Shut the fuck up and listen. Interracial John. Interracial John. Interracial shit motherfuckers. Shut up and listen. Drew and Leslie. Interracial John.
And welcome to the Interracial John Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined, as always,
by a very white guy.
And you are very white indeed. And I apologize in advance for my horrible voice this week.
It's a little different.
Yeah, it is a little different.
You're a horse.
I'm hoarse. I'm sick.
Yeah.
But, you know.
That's good.
Trying to get over this before we head.
Yeah, shout out to the tour of the Interracial John song there.
Yes.
That's Mr. Matthewson,
mm-hmm.
my brother. He's going to be on our trip.
Yes, he is. We'll see him soon.
Yeah, so is
my mustache!
I don't have a soundbite, but we got all kinds of be good time.
Yeah, it's going to be good. This is your first time joining us. Welcome. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Interracial John, that's J-A-W-N, you can go to our website, interracialjohn.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Periscope, at Interracial John, again, J-A-W-N. And we love feedback. We love it.
Yeah, you could do some five-star reviews. I haven't shamed people in a while, but shame.
Shame on you all.
Shame.
Yeah.
You're sick, and you're doing this, and, like, y'all could just do a five-star review. Like, that's all it takes. Like, it's click, 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 click. She's out here, like, like, you know, I'm not saying, like, deathbed, but maybe close to. I don't know. I don't know how I want to amp up the...
Let's hope it's not deathbed.
Yeah, let's hope it doesn't come to that. But yeah. She's... Listen to her voice, man. Come on.
Yes. Well, thank you. So, yeah, if you leave us a five-star review on iTunes or Stitcher, we will read it here on the air. You can also email us, interracialjohn@gmail.com, or you can pick up your phone, dial 657, Johners, that's 657, J-A-W-N-E-R-S, and leave us a voicemail. If it's under 3 minutes and not totally weird, we'll play it here on the air. And shout out to Rod and Karen from the Black Guy Who Tips for our general feedback rules.
Yeah, we should... Yeah, I'm surprised more people don't use the phone, right? Because that was my thing.
I think people
thing.
Are afraid about their up. About their voice sometimes. Maybe.
I guess.
Anyways, or like messing up or something.
Leaving something totally like ridiculous, and then like the podcast people are like, let's play this on the air over and over, over and over again.
It's a soundbite now.
Make daddy a sandwich. Like for the next 20 years. Like,
so we do, speaking of new soundbites, we have a new soundbite for emails. We do have some emails today.
And what the are you saying to us?
I would say feedback in general.
Now,
what
feedback.
The are you saying to us?
Like, the fuck are you saying to us?
That's from Black Ink.
The best part of that Chicago. Sound clip was like the new tattoo artist, Cobra is her name,
yeah.
has OCD and mm-hmm. she's cleaning up all kinds of shit and like all over the place and like literally says something like, the spray bottle will turn into AIDS. Like,
she says, you have hepatitis C in your cup and then it'll jump and it'll turn into AIDS in your spray bottle. That's
And so the soundbite says, what the fuck are you saying? He goes, man, you're saying the spray bottle got AIDS and my paper towel got hep C? What the fuck are you saying to us? So just keep that in mind.
Yeah. So what the fuck are you saying to us, everybody? We have a couple of emails, so I'll go through those. Subject, hair, Latina, and black women.
Mm. Okay.
Hello, Leslie. Guess it wasn't just for me. I have a situation at work that is making me uncomfortable on many levels. Uh-oh. I am a brown-skinned, racially ambiguous, 26-year-old Latina with black curly hair. 3A/B if you do the whole hair typing shit. Gotcha, sis. I wear my hair curly to work now, but used to straighten it occasionally. One of my coworkers is a black woman in her late 40s or 50s. She always, always would compliment and touch my hair when it was straight and told me how much she wished she had hair like mine. Now that it's always curly, she still touches my hair and runs her fingers through my curls. Ah! That's the sound of the emoji she put. While telling me how much she wished she had hair like mine. This makes me so, so uncomfortable. Not only because she is literally in my space and touching my body, but because I know what it's like to be a woman of color who resents her own features and envies someone else's. I know I may seem like I'm projecting here, but it's all about the sad tone of her voice that makes me feel sad about this. My knee-jerk reaction is to smile uncomfortably and then complain to her about how much work and money my hair requires. I know this is an empty deflection technique. How do I handle the situation without offending her or sounding snobby? I'd like to still be friendly with her. Thanks so much. Love the show, Laura. Hmm. That is a quandary. Well, first of all, like, the whole thing about her touching your hair, like, I think you can just say that and just be like, I'd prefer if you didn't touch my hair. And if you don't want to make her feel uncomfortable, you can say, like, you know, it gives other people the impression they can touch my hair too. So, you know, if you could just help me out and not make that a normal thing that happens so that other people don't feel like they can do it also, she might be able to receive that and not take it personally. So that would be one suggestion. And also, that's hella true. Like, when our agency is taken away in front of other people, it makes them think it's okay for our agency to be taken away. So that's actually really legit. Regarding, like, her feelings about it, I mean, I don't know. I think you'd have to be, like, closer to her to really have that kind of a conversation about, you know, internalized oppression and, you know, self-hatred and all of those kinds of things. But, you know, you might talk about how much you like her hair, if you do, instead. So that might be one way to kind of, like, turn it around a little bit and just talking about how you like diverse hair. So that would be one way of getting that message out without it being like, hey, stop hating yourself. So anyways, that's my advice.
Not to interject because it's not my dialogue, obviously, but I recall your, let's say, natural hair journey maybe predated having some more language and, you know, I wasn't understanding, but just language around internalized depression. And I remember with the beginning of your natural hair journey, and not to call her out, but your mom was kind of a little bit like, you know, she was on that, like, oh, I prefer it was straight. Like, I thought it was better.
She, like, always had this, like, yeah, well, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do with it?
What are you going to do with it?
When are you going to do your hair?
Just, like, going to let, like, it be.
No, but, like, you would, like, anything. Finger coil it. It would take, like, hours and hours and hours. Then she, what are you going to do with it? I did. It's done.
That's it.
But so what was, and I don't think you talked to her about internalized depression, but how did you, because I don't think she talks like that anymore.
Well, I think it's just about, like, just styles being different now. Mm. And, like, the funny thing is, like, she wasn't even relaxed at that time because once she cut her hair short, she stopped relaxing her hair.
Oh, no, and I loved it.
So it's, like, weird. And she also, like, my mom had to get a relaxer, like, once a year. Like, it was, like, she wasn't somebody that relaxed on a regular basis.
Well, but she was, at that time, she was dyeing it, too. She was coloring
it. Yeah, she was coloring it also.
And she's got beautiful gray hair.
And then, of course, like, all my sisters now are, well, not Andrea, but the other ones are natural. And Karen, she's like me. She just lets it do what it do. And Denise has locks now, which are amazing and gorgeous, and my mom just has natural hair. I just think it's just, you know, a matter of, like, yeah, just
times.
Like, cultural changes, mm-hmm. and things. Yeah, and also I think she was like, she just doesn't like short hair. I don't know what it is, even though she has short hair now. So, and I had been cutting my hair short for, like, a long time, and then I had grown it out a bit before I did my big chop. I think she was more like thinking I was gonna keep my length.
And I don't know, my only experience is with, I would say, mostly West Indian. Or, you know, Caribbean black folk here, uh-huh. of that diaspora. And it maybe, I don't know, it seems, or my hypothesis is that perms and relaxers are done a little bit younger than maybe normal. I don't know.
No, I mean, I think people be doing that shit young.
Mm.
Just period. So, yeah. Mm. I mean.
All right. We got more mail?
Hopefully less. We do. Second email.
Well, good luck with that.
Yes,
I hope,
good
I hope
luck.
It goes
write us back and let us know how it goes.
Yeah. And
hopefully
please,
the advice was useful.
I absolutely hope no one touches you.
Yeah. Don't do it. Yeah. I think you can have that part of the conversation easily. So you're not uncomfortable. And then, you know, that's important.
Who wrote that? I'm reading this next headline. Good luck.
Subject, congrats. Hi, Drew and Leslie. Congrats on your number one cuck status. We're going to Disneyland.
I have no longer. I changed my name from Uncle Cuckus. And you, if you search Cuck, I no longer come up.
Woo!
Within the.
Now we're going to Universal Studios.
It's no longer Disneyland. It was Disneyland. First of all, it wasn't Disney World. They started at Disneyland. Cucks don't go to Disney World. They go to Disneyland.
Disneyland. I just purchased a Raise Better White People t-shirt.
Ooh, thank you very
thank
much
you for that.
Supporting
I hope that helps Leslie get some form of compensation on your upcoming vacation after all the hard work. It will. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Drew, you mentioned how wearing this shirt, I can expect a lot of side eye or even nasty words from fellow white people. I was just curious if you have a quick retort that you give when somebody asks something like, what's that supposed to mean? I'm good at explaining it in longer form, but brevity has never been my strong point. If I had to be quick, I'd probably say something like, our society loves to point the finger and place the burden on black people for race issues, when in fact it's us white people who are to blame and need to fix things. Let me know if that misses anything or if there's an even quicker way of getting the point across. Thanks for all the stuff you guys have discussed recently. The breakdown of the ways the media uses subtle pro-police language in much of its reporting was really helpful, and the discussion about why a Yelp-like reviewing system for police accountability is nearly impossible to achieve was excellent and depressing. P.S. Alex Trebek is a proud libertarian, so his dickish attitude is never much of a surprise. Love you guys, John. Thanks for the email, John. I'll let Drew, I'll let you reply.
Yeah, I don't know if I've come up with a witty retort. Like, and it's funny, what's that supposed to mean? Like, clearly you've worn the shirt. That's like 9 out of 10 times. You're like, what do you mean by that? I'll show you better white people. Like, you're doing it right now. And I usually like it means what it is. It's pretty clear. White people got to do better.
Yeah. You know? It's funny to me, too, because, like, white people have no problem having all sorts of, like, general outlandish things to say about black parenting and black parents and black children. Like, outlandish-ass shit. One, like, well, if you had your fathers around, yeah, like, all that kind of shit. But one...
Get your pants up. Stop using the N-word.
Super generalized, like, just raise better white people.
Just do better.
Like,
just do better.
How dare you?
The temerity.
Just the
gall. And you know what it is? It's because it's an effrontery to that they're the best. We're the best, right? Like, that juxtaposition of white as superior and everything else is inferior. Ooh. When you say raise better white people, it's like, well, what do you mean? We're the best.
I've been meaning to make this clarification on the air, because it's not just like when we talk about the concept of anti-blackness, right? Not just racism itself. When we talk about the concept of anti-blackness, the two juxtapositions are not humane and inhumane. It's human and animal, right? So the closer you are to whiteness, the more human you are, and the less you are, the more you are to animal. And that's where you see like physical agency being taken away,
because
that's what you do to an animal. You can lord over it. You can decide everything for it. You can tell it what to do. So I just was making that
thank
general
you. That's a good point. That's a very good point. But so I would usually say, like, it's pretty clear, I generally say white supremacy is a white creation, a white problem, and we got to get white people to stop it. We got to raise better white people to tear it down. Yeah. But there isn't really a quick and I like what John you said. I think that's a good our society loves to point the finger and place the burden on black people for race issues, when in fact it's us white people. And I wouldn't even say race issues, black people for everything. In fact, it's us white people who are to blame and need to fix things. And that, I mean, that's really like,
I would, if you wanted to be more succinct, like I would say something like, racism was created by and is perpetuated by white people. So we are the ones that have to fix it. And I would even, if you needed to be really short, I would say
I wouldn't say race, I'd say white supremacy.
Yeah.
Name it. Yeah.
I think white supremacy is good, but the thing about that, though, is like you're using words that sometimes will be missed by people. Mm. And so you really have to, like, when you're having conversations like this, if you really want to give them a true answer, like you can't use terminology just because it sounds cool to you. And because it's correct, yes, but there is a level of like assumed knowledge that I think can become very elitist and make you sound like really like.
I hear you. And white anti-racist people can be very condescending. I don't use white terms because I think it sounds cool. I use it because it's more appropriate.
But that also assumes people understand what that is.
And
I don't think that they do. I think people hear white supremacy and they think of like apartheid and the KKK and.
And I think when you use racism, the people you're talking about instantly think, well, that's not me. I'm not a racist. That's a hooded Klansman. So, okay. And then they'll go home and think, well, I am raising better people. That wasn't meant for me. You know, that was meant for the racist KKK hooded Klansman that I don't really know about.
Mm, maybe. I don't know. Does the other not let them think that still?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. Like I said, I haven't, that may be good. The next step in the raise better white people t-shirt is like actually having, cause it really, it is kind of like a statement of some sort, and it should be a conversation starter, but it generally starts conversation with the people that are the most upset and the people that are the most offended by it. And they're, I don't say the least likely to listen, but you know, yeah, I don't know.
Maybe you should have something on that says like, ask me about my shirt.
Yeah,
I feel like that would be interesting. Like to have the secondary piece of it
I'm
to
with
engage,
you. Like a button,
and see what happens. Yeah, because I
ask
mean,
me.
Because I feel like if you have asked me about your shirt, you might get people that are more in line with you talking to you. Also, you might have more people like instead of just nodding or thinking to themselves like, "Yeah, right on," they might actually say something to you because you're inviting them to.
Well,
so you might be able to tip the scales. And also, I feel like if it's an angry, they'll know that you're like ready, and like they may not say shit to you because of that. Also,
yeah,
where they're like, "Oh, this guy's ready to." Step to me, I'm gonna not like get into an argument with him in the middle of Walmart or whatever the fuck. So
yeah,
of course here, you know, people in Walmart are strapped, so you might want to think about that also.
Honest to God,
and I'm not meaning that in
we were in Cleveland, and the woman that was upset about it could have and very easily would have kicked my ass. She was much bigger person than I was.
Her and her husband.
Oh, was she upset?
She was
pissed. And didn't want to have any conversation about it. It was just like on her breath and, you know. And what if I had a shirt that said raise better black people? Oh, of course. You're going to go there? You know what? That would be really racist if you had that because you're white.
Just ridiculous.
Every time. What if I had a shirt that raised better black people? Well, you'd be really fucking racist.
You'd be racist. Ta-da.
Ding.
Which it sounds like you already are, so I don't, I think it's kind of redundant. Okay. Next email. This is the last one. Subject at long last.
What the are you saying to us?
Sorry, I had to get one more in there.
One more in there. Subject at long last. Hey, Leslie and Drew. At long last, I'm writing to speak about this 5-star podcast of yours. I love it so much. I first started listening to it to support Leslie because she's like a big sister to me and I unexpectedly have become addicted. It was the first podcast I really followed on a regular basis. With your podcast, we were able to catch up on current events, social issues, and just listen to some ratchet stories about family, friends, and famous people. I like to think that I'm really good at keeping up with the ins and outs of pop culture and television, things like that, but you two amaze me at how you know all of the things.
That's Leslie. That's not us. Trust me. That's all her.
I'm not as good as I used to be. Like a lot of
Your memory is powerful. Yeah, it's borderline. What's that? Photographic, eidetic. And then you consume a lot, right? Like there's
not as much as I used to. That's why
correct.
I mean, I really
but there's still there's hours of TV that I don't touch that you watch.
That's true. I watch TV while I'm working. So
yeah.
You can talk about something that happened at one of the presidential debates with the same fervor and zeal as talking about white people doing racist things or the last episode of The Flash, which was very good, by the way.
That's a nice little triumvirate there.
This podcast is like if my thoughts would actually coalesce into a composed order with wit and plenty of spilled tea. Aww. Nice. One of my favorite segments is when you rate apologies. People half-ass those so much, it's refreshing to hear someone call them out on it. I find myself rating them whenever I count an article or situation where one is offered. Us too.
Yeah.
The black in me, the activist in me, and the woman in me appreciate the serious discussion on how black folk are treated and how we can continue to fight against this treatment. I'm grateful that through your podcast, I was able to listen to more and celebrate and discuss what it means to be black in America. And though you've heard this a million times, your dynamic is great. Even when y'all are low key side eyeing each other over something, I look forward to the many episodes still to come from this podcast. I have gone on to listen to several other podcasts and colors that get me through the day, The Read, Another Round, and TBDWT, to name a few. Also, I just started Insecurity, the new podcast with Crystal and Fran about Issa Rae's new show, Insecure. Podcasts are lit. Antoinette.
Thanks, Antoinette. That was a really nice one. I feel bad putting that. What the fuck are you saying to us today?
That's us. A few other things just to plug before we start talking about other shit is one, you can go to our Teespring store. You can get t-shirts, hoodies, right. Long sleeve t-shirts, mugs, tote bag, I think. So you can go to teespring.com/stores/interracialjohn.
Yeah, they're very, go on, sorry.
What are you trying to say?
I thought they were all under the same store, but the John has a different store. So continue.
No, that is the John store.
I know, but continue.
Okay, gotcha. And then Run, Jesse, Run. We have a t-shirt that I put together with Karen from The Black Guy Who Tips. Shout out to her. I'd say that again. And you can just go to teespring.com/run, Jesse, run. And it's a little celebratory shirt celebrating Jesse Quick's appearance and on the Flash, the TV show The Flash, speaking of. And last thing I wanted to plug, and shout out to Taylor because I know she listens to the show, is the Yarn Mission. Have you heard of the Yarn Mission, Drew?
I haven't, but we should also say, because we talked about the Raise Better White People t-shirt, and that is available at teespring.com/stores/Ferguson-response. So there's two ones. One that supports Leslie 100% Ferguson-response, and the person asked about, you know, hopefully I bought a shirt and that gives you something. 100% of the proceeds go right to Leslie and her work, so absolutely. And that's Ferguson-response, and you can get Raise Better White People, Black Lives Are More Important Than White Feelings. There's a great one, I Believe That We Will Win, which not a lot of people buy. I don't know why. I love that shirt. Mm-hmm. It's got a black woman on it. It's really cool. And then Stay Woke, Morum Experga Factus. I guess it's Latin for Stay Woke. I don't know, but there's a bunch of good shirts, good for white people, and that's available in addition to the John store that Leslie mentioned. We'll have all those on the the website.
So the Yarn Mission is this really amazing organization that uses knitting to support and contribute to the struggle for Black liberation. And it's really just amazing project. And they have chapters and people that participate in it all over the country, and they knit things. You can shop the items that they knit, and the money goes to pay people for the work that they're doing. And it's a lot of organizers that knit. I'm sure if any of you have been in Movement Spaces, at least 1 to 12 people in any meeting will have knitting needles out and be knitting something. Yeah, Nina's a knitter.
Who's the person with the Yarn Mission that we met in?
I just said Taylor. So, and shout out to her. And so you can go to theyarnmission.com to see more about them. And you can also, there's a shop link right on the page, and you can go to yarnmission.com/shop, and you can shop for all the things. And they just do really amazing work. And they have a check for local meetups, because they have meetups where a bunch of people just meet to knit as well, and a bunch of other dope things. So check them out.
I haven't started yet, because I really I'm way behind on so many of the things. But you know, I've got that sewing machine. I like to sew now.
Yeah, you do like to sew.
And I want to start making like weighted throws, like weighted blanket kind of deals, as like kind of hugs and stuff that we could send to different.
That'd be dope.
Actors.
But you should make them like small.
Oh yeah, yeah. The one I have is retarded. It's huge. Ableist is a bad word. The one I have is way too big. It probably costs like $50 just to ship it. It's silly. No, I would make it more.
Like a lap duvet, a little like.
There's one that's a little bit bigger than it's like that scarf you have, but maybe not quite that big.
Okay, like the circle scarf. Or?
Yeah. Oh, that would be kind of neat, like a circle one.
Yeah.
Because then you could have like a sling, like a little hug kind of deal.
I don't have to do a little testing for that.
Well, I spoke with I don't want to use her name on the I don't know what she goes by on Facebook and other things.
Okay, you spoke with somebody.
Lofty Intentions on Twitter.
Got it,
my friend, and they're a sewer too, and we're gonna. Talk about
sewing some things. Yeah. That's cool. So you wanted to talk about you were putting together some ads, speaking of, for the Teespring campaigns.
The Ferguson Response Teespring campaign, like I've read from other people that Teespring's really integrated with Facebook, so you can do like, you know, like pretty tight analytics, like this is the group and this is the, you know, a purchase of a Teespring shirt makes a campaign success, like metric, like API tie-in,
really good and it's effective.
Yeah,
if you get sales.
Teespring wants you to, they want to, Teespring has made it easy and facilitated it for people to spend money advertising on Facebook in order to sell more t-shirts, which is great for Teespring.
Because it's such an impulse buy anyways.
Of course.
Like you see it and it's like, oh, that's the exact thing. And they have built a name that people trust. Like it's going to be a good shirt, blah, blah, blah.
Right. It's Teespring.
Right.
So I was looking into that. And I don't know which end. I should have started on the Teespring side, but I started on the Facebook side. And right away, I mean like right away, like they give you like, okay, let's target your ads. Like, you know, that's what you do. You don't want to just like throw an ad up to everybody. That wouldn't be very effective. You'd lose a lot of money, right?
Well, of course.
Of course. You got to like narrow the like possible recipients. And demographic is, you know, okay, great. Click on demographic. Very first ones like ethnicity. Great. Click on ethnicity. Up there was like everything but white. Like you could click Asian, like Asian American, like I think there was like three different Latinx versions, like Mexican, born in Mexico, Mexican descent. Not like really, there was a bunch of different demographics for Black and like African American, but nothing at all for white.
That does not surprise me.
No, it doesn't either.
The default is white. So
yeah,
you're gonna get them.
Yeah, but you couldn't even like exclude white,
right?
Which was kind of like, I don't want to say weird, but like I don't know. I just thought that, you know, we talk about that a lot, the normative, the default. And I think there's even a dialogue on Twitter about that maybe a week or so ago, you were telling me. But, yeah, Facebook. I saw a great article, I don't know if I can find it, about Twitter and not like why it's a fucking mess with trolling and bullshit. But a lot of it is from the culture they had of this just like deep, deep abiding faith in First Amendment and the platform as a First Amendment. And it's rooted in the fact that they're all white men.
Yeah, but I also feel like, I don't know, just they were a bunch of like, when you think of like where it came from, it was like supposed to be for finding chicks. So to me, it's kind of like this level of like expecting.
Twitter was for finding chicks.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking about Facebook.
No, Twitter. No. I'm talking about Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Twitter for sure. You're right.
They left. I forget what space. I think it was Blogger and at Google, all of them.
Yeah.
And Blogger was having issues with. You know, comments and inappropriate content, And so they had a team of people, a lot of them, that spent time on moderating content. Google still does that. They hire people all over the world to like moderate YouTube and all kinds of content on their fucking platform. And now that's like, you know, on some level subjective. Like there's some rules, but then an individual at one point is subjectively deciding how to apply that, right?
Right.
And they're doing it like not necessarily in real time, but like after the fact. Gets loaded, content gets shared. Oops, now I got to take it down and do something about it. And so they didn't want to do that. They're like, we got to programmatically and algorithmically, we got to, you know, figure it out. And their way to figure it out was to just have it be so open, you know, like they're staunch, like, you know, First Amendment, free speech. Like, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to algorithmically anything. And they would have like conversations like, oh, we should try to ban the word cunt. Well, but people in the UK use the word cunt as an adoring kind of like, oh, you silly cunt. Like, that'll, you know, you can't filter based on content. So like, they really, I guess, like, I don't say they thought about it, but they just, their fierce dedication to this open concept of,
which is so
speech.
Funny because like, who's ever tried to silence these motherfuckers? Like ever.
But that's my point though, that like that attitude would only be held by like a bunch of like 20 something white dudes.
Yeah.
You know, like if you had any kind of women in there, they'd be like, wait a minute, have you been on our platform? Like, have you spent a week? You know? Like,
mm-hmm.
And I think I think that this article, I shouldn't say, I think this article espoused that's how it was formed. Like that's, you know, that's like the DNA of Twitter, and that it can't get away from that. That's baked into its culture. Mm. And now it's just like, it's like a medium for hate. I mean, it really almost is. Mm. It really almost is. Like I get it. Like, it's done great stuff and it's still connecting people in the Black Liberation Movement, but like, holy fuck. It's just like, And you can see it. Like, anytime I have any tweet, anytime any person I know has any tweet, like it gets like, I don't know, like 30 or 40 retweets. It's like, oh, here it comes. You know, that's just visible enough to like bleep, blop, bloop. Here's the fucking horrible.
Mm.
The other day I had one about Ricky Vaughn, and his little acolytes got a hold of it. And I just logged down. It's like, it'll be over in 24 hours.
Yeah, they're such dick bags.
But it was just nonstop.
Of course it is. So obviously lots of stuff going on at Standing Rock. Lots of folks headed out there. Big clergy call last week. I think like 500 clergy went. A lot of UUs went as well.
We have friends there. Hope they're doing well.
Lena was there, so that was cool. Rapping Black Lives UU and all of that. It's been interesting, the Standing Rock thing. It's been giving me a lot of things to think about.
You and I had a conversation, was it last week?
Mm.
I think it was last week, about... I don't make sure I'm not saying this incorrectly, but something with the framing of and some of the language surrounding Standing Rock and the struggle and the fight, you know, it seems to have erased Native rights and the treaty with Native Americans in favor of water and other sort of environmental concerns.
I started that conversation like just thinking about how different people's reactions to Standing Rock have been versus, you know, protests for Black Lives Matter.
White
people's
reactions.
And not just white people, just reaction, just period. Because the media is part of this. There's a lot of different like areas where you see differences, right? But certainly white people, if we narrow in specifically to that, and I would even narrow it a little further and just say faith.
Yeah, like our faith. Okay? Our faith, Unitarian Universalist.
So it's been interesting
the
watching
media
that.
We've seen,
you know,
response.
The quickness with which they were able to, you know, rally themselves, have to be convinced, have to be
the sum totality with which the message was understood and the alacrity with which it was responded to is really those two things really right. Like you said, they understood the message, got it clear, here, understood, and then they responded, you know, I wouldn't say immediately, but have we responded to the Black Lives call?
No. And so then the other thing I would say is that then I started thinking, like, did they really understand the messaging, though? And I realized that, you know, part of it is that they've been able to reframe, or I should say frame, Standing Rock and supporting Standing Rock in a very specific way that centers themselves. So they've been able to say water is life, and it's about water rights, and it's about, you know, the environment and the earth and taking care of the earth, right? Which is true. The pipeline itself is about that. But the stand at Standing Rock is not just about this pipeline. It's about indigenous feminist sovereignty. It's about colonialism. It's about our federal government supporting capitalism over its treaties that it's had with Native Americans. And this is a continuation of 500 years of oppression and colonialism against Native land and Native people. So it's interesting to watch them like just, oh, that's, we're not going to talk about that stuff, but let's talk about the indigenous. Let's talk about the environmental issues. Let's talk about water. Let's talk about why pipelines are bad. Let's talk about all of this kind of stuff. So I feel like part of it is that they've been able to frame it in a certain way. But then I also read things like in the media this morning, I read like the headline was something like, you know, Humvees on one side and indigenous people on horses on the other. This is the stand that for, you know, this is the stand like no other stand. And if that doesn't show you exactly which side you need to be on, then nothing will. Right.
The tweet I saw was, this is the most important photo of the year. And it was a, you know, the debris roadblock that's been created. And all the military vehicles on one side and, you know, an indigenous individual on horseback on the other side.
Right. And so that messaging and that kind of like, you know, just puts me in mind of, because like when I saw that same setup in Ferguson, you know, immediately after Mike Brown's murder and certainly through the non-indictment decision, that's the thing that has been like, it's what galvanized me when I was standing there, like watching these young people with like bullhorns and, you know, their hands up, face off against literally armed machine vehicles, guns and tanks and military vehicles on our streets.
Officer Ray, I'll shoot you in the fucking face, Albers, pointing at M60 in your...
When I saw that, I was like, this is some other level shit. Like, to me, like a coup had occurred and our rights were just... We didn't have rights anymore.
No, they were suspended.
And it was very clear that that's what was going on. And so to me, it's like, how come you didn't see it in Ferguson or Baltimore or New York or Chicago or Cleveland or Charlotte or all those places? And so it's like, and again, this is not about like Standing Rock is an important place. I'm glad everyone's showing up for it. I personally have been supporting it. I've been supporting people that have been going there. I think the movement itself and organizations connected to it, including Ferguson Response, have been very clear about our support. So it's nothing about...
You've been posting no DB.
Yeah, this isn't movement about that. This is about what the response has been and like what... why there's difference there, how there's some need to like kind of tease out why that is, because it would be able to inform us how to be a more effective and also call white people to like be better on their shit and talk to their people about what, like, use this as an illustrating moment. Oh, this is it. It says, the white horse and the Humvee, Standing Rock is offering us a choice. And I was like, oh, Standing Rock is offering us a choice. Cool. Got it. It's very interesting.
That's a specific framing.
Very specific. So anyways, I just thought that that was interesting and something I've been thinking about. The other thing I wanted to talk about was this tweet by one at Chris Michelle. Shout out to Chris Michelle. I'm going to tag her. I told her I would.
Okay.
Who got married
ooh, congratulations.
This week. Congratulations to at Jay Glass. Congratulations to both of them. Wonderful.
Please clap.
So she had posted a beautiful montage with some photos from their wedding. They're gorgeous, like a beautiful wedding. And the caption said, at 7 we met. At 13 you promised me the fairy tale wedding of my dreams if I stayed by your side. At 20 you made it all come true. And I was like, oh, I want to talk about this. She was interested to hear what I had to say. Some people had some snotty things. I wasn't saying anything bad. It put me in mind as we're coming up on our
15th. What was the snotty thing you were saying?
Oh, just like how can I have an opinion about people I don't even know? And it's like,
snotty things about you saying that you had.
Yeah, but whatever. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Chris Michelle was very kind.
They don't know you.
And she was very interested to hear what we had to say. So whatever. And shout out to her. And again, congratulations. You guys look beautiful. Wishing you nothing but like eons and eons of happiness. But it occurred to me, thinking about our 15 years of marriage, what we might bring to this young couple starting out, first off, here in their new life together. And so young, younger even than we were. I was 25 when we got married. So
yeah,
I thought I was young. 20 is much younger than that. And I often say like, oh, if a 25-year-old asked me if they should get married now, I'd be like, no, wait. Even though it worked out great for us and I'm happy that I did it. And I also wouldn't have waited. Speaking about the two of us getting married.
What do you mean you wouldn't have waited?
Like, if I had to go back and do it again, I wouldn't have done any differently.
Ah, yeah. But, I mean, I thought young, and these individuals even younger.
Yes, they are. But it did put me in mind something we talk about all the time, which is about, you know, weddings and marriages, right?
Mm.
Because Chris, and she had other tweets about it, but I'm talking specifically about this one tweet where she talked about being promised a fairy tale wedding of her dreams. And we always talk about how, you know, you throw a wedding, but you plan a marriage and how important that is. And I'm sure if you knew each other from age 7, you guys have planned lots of things together, including your marriage, I hope. But it's something I always repeat to young people when they're getting serious, they're moving forward, and they start getting really involved in the wedding piece of it, which I love wedding. I love a party. Look, I'll throw a party any day of the week. I love throwing parties. But the planning piece is not really about the party. You know, you need to plan for the marriage part. And I think we did a decent job planning our marriage. Obviously, things are going to come up. I think we planned really well to deal with the things that would come
up. I think we, and I don't mean this in like a, that we didn't plan, but more than like consciously and actively plan, I think that we were just wise in our decisions and our, you know, we just knew each other. We knew I had a good sense of myself. You had a good sense of yourself, what you needed and wanted. Like, there wasn't a lot of like, we just made good decisions that I think have enabled more than I think we actually planned.
I don't know. I feel like there was a lot of planning. Like, when I think back about some of the like ways in which we decided that we were going to communicate, like when we couldn't decide where to go eat and neither of us wanted to make a decision, and it would be like, you know, I'll pick three and you just choose one of the three. And that doesn't sound like planning, but what that does is it sets up a level of communication that really works well for both of us and allows us to be more at ease with each other in these small decisions, and they lead to better conversations than larger ones. So
I guess I think of that as being practical, pragmatic, and making smart decisions, but that is planning.
Yeah,
that's the nature of
it. That's what I mean. You can't plan for like what's going to happen. That's just a fool's errand. But what you can do is make sure that you're prepared. And that's what the planning is to me anyways. When it comes to a marriage, it's like, how are we going to communicate with each other? How are we going to continue to stay close to each other? How are we going to fit into in each other's lives in a meaningful way? How are we going to support each other? How are we going to deal with each other when things are difficult? You know, those are the things you have to plan around. And then when the stuff pops up, you already have navigated some of how you're going to do those things, and it makes it a lot easier. So,
and so what your comment is that Chris's tweet, is it Chris Michelle, I guess?
Chris Michelle, yeah.
Tweet that went, I guess, viral. Got,
you know, yeah, a lot of 62,000 tweets.
Yeah, you're saying that you think she's focusing more on the wedding?
No, she had a lot of other tweets about her wedding. I was just talking about this because when I see something go viral, what spoke to people, not to Chris, Michelle, and Jay. They are excited about all of the things that are around because this wasn't the only tweet she had about her marriage and her wedding and her engagement and her relationship. I'm talking about the virality of it and why people were like, this is the one that I want to retweet a bunch. It's because of this fairy tale wedding promise that's in it. And I think out of context, you can look at that and say, ooh, the wedding was the important thing. And I know I looked at both Chris, Michelle, and Jay's timelines that's not true of either of them. This was just one tweet that she sent about the wedding, but the rest of her tweets surrounding her relationship and this momentous occasion were about their love for each other and their relationship and how strong it is and all of the things that I'm talking about. So this isn't about her. It was about what makes it go viral. And I think a lot of people make that mistake of thinking that the wedding is the thing and that's the achievement that you get. And it's like, no, a wedding is a celebratory moment, but the achievement part is the marriage piece. So
I'm with you on that. Yeah. And I think maybe someone came sideways at you for your tweet. If they interpret it as you having some comment about her, your comment's really not about her. It's about the virability of the tweet and what other people thought about it.
Yeah. That's something I hear all the time.
Yeah, and best of luck to
yeah,
her.
Yeah, I think,
and,
I mean, honestly, and the wedding looks beautiful, and yeah, I'm sure they're going to be
a gorgeous couple.
Extremely happy and wonderful, and congratulations to them.
Jamal, Jay Glass, and
wishing you many, Chris, many more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, I'll just say this, because we're coming on 15 years, and we've talked a couple of different times, and I think you said something the other day that we both kind of reiterated, and I've heard from other long married couples, is don't, and I don't say like fall out of love at the same time is wrong way of saying it, but
kind of the right way,
you know, like, you know that it's going to be a long journey and you're not going to be at the same place always at the same time, and don't fall out of love and go to the worst place at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've even spoken to like people that have gone through divorce that are like, man, it would have been easier to stay together. I wish we had figured out a way to make it work.
Well, I think that there's always this like expectation of like, everything's always going to be great. Yeah. And it's just not. Like, you are going to get on each other's nerves. If you've had a friend for longer than 10 fucking years, you know that you're going to get on each other's nerves. And you're with your spouse even more than you are with that person. So I just always feel like, you know, those moments of irritability and conflict, like, they don't, those are not the measure of your relationship. So don't overemphasize them when you're taking a tally of how you are together and what you're like together. It's really easy for us to, in those moments, like, amplify them and make them much larger than in the really long tail of things than they really are. And that's hard to do in the moment. I appreciate that. But I also think that's part of the commitment piece, you know, the better or worse part of the vows. That's what that means, is that you are agreeing to work through those bad times because they are not the sum total of your relationship.
Yeah. And I'll say that people that know us and are close to us, like, I don't know exactly how they would say it, but like, I think the general consensus sometimes, and not as much, but earlier on in our marriage, like, man, you guys love hard and you fight hard.
Yeah, we fight all the time.
You guys love really good, but you fight good too.
Yeah.
And see that on the podcast, like, y'all just get the, like, this is like date night. You get the, like, you're like, oh, you guys' connection is so great. It's like, it is. You're right. You're great. But, like, you know, we don't podcast when we're, like, fighting.
I mean, we tried to do this podcast 2 days ago and we fought, so we couldn't do it. So
on the radio, it happens.
It happens. Well, let's get started.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
The news is coming on. The news is coming on.
I love that girl.
I know.
Where are we here? So University of Michigan exec started an investigation over mistreatment of black patients and ended up getting fired.
No surprise.
Yeah, I just, it's like, fuck, are you kidding me? You're like, in Michigan, too.
Of course it is.
Former U of M professor and hospital executive is suing, good for them, after the institution, she says she was fired for conducting an investigation in a study that claims that black patients were treated unfairly by University of Michigan health staff and system. According to MLive, Dr. Carmen Green, who was appointed to the newly created position of associate vice president, associate dean for health equity and inclusion. So just, I'm just going to say that's the role that the Dr. Green was fired from, vice president and associate dean for health equity and inclusion. She became troubled when a UM health system chaplain reported that hospital staff were seemingly calling security on black patients and their visitors for no reason. Allegations led to a tenured professor to conduct a study which found that UMH staff disproportionately 2.5 times more often reached for the phone to call security when confronted with black visitors or patients that became emotional in the emergency room. Imagine
emotional
in an emergency room. Go figure.
Mm-mm.
Intensive care waiting rooms, surgical waiting rooms. So not just the emergency room, intensive care and surgical waiting rooms. Well, I can't imagine being emotional in any of those places. Green's study also found disparities in access to pain treatment, of course, we know that, for African Americans, women, and low-income patients. Presented her findings to the UMHS officials in December of last year, and the civil suit argues that UM administrators fired her from her position a month later in an act of retaliation for the damning report. A month.
A month.
30 days, y'all.
Fuck out of here.
She's seeking a half mil. I hope Dr. Green, and she's black, of course.
Of course.
Of course. I just... You know, like that was her title, Vice President, Associate Dean for Health, Equity, and Inclusion. So it was basically just bullshit. Oh, we got a black woman. We're going to give her this title. But as soon as she discovers anything we don't want to hear, no, she's out. And I don't say you see that all the time, but I see that a lot. I see this, like, you're like, oh, we're into diversity. We've got a person in charge of diversity. A person on Twitter. I forget his handle, but he does the... I'm sick of racist... even white people are sick of white people's bullshit. I always keep that, let that playing. She keeps going. But the t-shirt that says, even white people are sick of white people's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Finn Silencio. But in real life, he was at a school... And was in charge of, you know, again, like kind of like some things, like I think admissions or diversity. And there was a bunch of bullshit with like white people and, you know, all these preferential treatment, like a really big one, big named stuff, raised the red flag and like, nope, you got to go. Like whistle. As soon as you blow the whistle on like, you know, deliberately subverting diversity and inclusion and other things, they don't want to hear it. Institutions don't want to hear it. Even the people they assign. This woman's title was like vice president of inclusion and equity. And it's like, hey, listen, it's inequitable.
Mm-hmm.
you got to go. Don't tell us that. We know what we're doing. Calling the cops on black people.
For sure. Well, a little nicer thing from a legal side of things is the Ask for Angela campaign. Which is how a UK council is keeping women safe in bars and clubs. So this local UK council, it's in Lincolnshire, I think, isn't where it is. Make sure, yeah, Lincolnshire County Council, and it was created by council member Haley Child. Good on for her. So it's called hashtag No More, and it says it has these things. It's posted in like bathrooms, women's bathrooms of like bars and clubs, and it says, "Hi, I'm Angela. Are you on a date that isn't working out? Do you feel like you're not in a safe situation? Is your Tinder or POF? I guess that's another like, I don't know." Dating app date not who they said they were in their profile. Does it all feel a bit weird? If you go to the bar and ask for Angela, the bar staff will know you need some help getting out of the situation, and you and will call you a taxi or help you out discreetly without too much fuss.
Wow,
pretty smart, huh?
And bars participate in this program.
Yep. Good, so they participate, they put it up, and then the bartenders are trained to just know like how to deal with it and stuff.
I'd go to that bar. I go to bars with that deliberately, if it was Tinder dates and shit.
Yeah, for sure. Especially because, like, the person knows your contact info. Like, you don't want to cause a big scene. You never know when people are going to just go crazy.
Yeah.
So they plan to relaunch it again in February 2017 to coincide with the UK's National Sexual Violence and Abuse Awareness Week. And I'm hoping people pick it up here. I think it's a really smart campaign, super easy to do, low costs on all sides, and really super effective. So, yeah.
Provided the manager of the bar is not actually named Angela, that's going to work very well.
It works great, yeah. Works so, cool. No more Angela. Angela's managers was bars.
Yeah. There was a story I saw that was about emu found wandering along the interstate. I'm going to see if there's a news clip I can play here.
Now here's something you don't see every day. Friday, an emu was spotted just strolling along the interstate in Phoenix. Look at this. State trooper arrived and found
he
that emu
his head
in the
window.
Median. So he seemed a little curious about the officer, and you can see him popping his head in the window of the cruiser. An agriculture officer was able to safely load that emu into a trailer and move him to safety.
His face, I don't know why, but this cute little video is like...
Emus are just like, their face is always like, huh?
He's in the trailer and he pokes his head on like, bloop, look at me, I'm an emu.
Hilarious.
I don't know why I thought that was cute.
Emus are hilarious. So I saw this amazing political ad from this year, and I just feel like everybody should hear it. It's for Gerald Daugherty. He's running for re-election of the Travis, Texas County Commissioner.
Okay.
And here's his ad.
Texas.
We've got room to put 2,700 people in our jail, and it costs us about $103 a day.
Gerald really doesn't have any hobbies.
Last year's tax rate was 0.4169. This year, we could take that down to 3838.
So is he always like that?
Yeah, all the time.
Which means that the 3838 is probably going to go somewhere between 3838 and 41.69.
Most people leave their work at the office.
We got three light rail cars. You can put 60 people on each car. So even if you add two cars, you're talking about maybe 300 people that are affected. There are a million people in this community. I mean, that is 0.01 to the 8th power. If you round it off, it's zero.
All he wants to do is fix things.
So I got this 18-wheeler that's parked in this neighborhood, viewing fumes all over the place, but quite frankly, it's not a code violation. You know, I think I like helping around the house here.
Please re-elect Gerald. Please.
It's his wife, dude.
She is over him. I thought it was really funny.
You know why you think it's really funny? I know why you think it's really funny.
Why?
Because that dude sounds like me. Spouting off fucking numbers.
Oh, yeah, just
shit,
like
dude.
Random numbers.
Yeah, he's like, oh, and the 6 and the 12 and the 17, the 54 open eyes.
That's definitely you, for sure. So the other thing I saw, Colin Kaepernick hosted a Know Your Rights camp for more than 100 kids this past week.
Like, Know Your Rights when it... encountering like police or like what?
Yeah. So he's making sure today's youth are equally woke about basic liberties and protections most Americans are deprived of each and every day. So we hosted this in Oakland, started with more than 100 kids in attendance, and it was pretty cool. He says it took 6 months to coordinate, which is long before he made headlines, and began all this talk in the
yeah, so all this like I wish you didn't do it by kneeling in the anthem, you should do it like Doug Baldwin and go in the communities and do things for real. You should just be kneeling in front of the anthem. You should do things for your community for real, fucker.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. The day included several breakout sessions, including a range of topics handpicked by Kaepernick, including financial success, what to do during interactions with police, college prep, nutrition, self-love, and more. The 10 points of Know Your Rights, he says, 1, you have the right to be free. 2, you have the right to be healthy. 3, you have the right to be brilliant. 4, you have the right to be safe. 5, you have the right to be loved. 6, you have the right to be courageous. 7, you have the right to be alive. 8, you have the right to be trusted. 9, you have the right to be educated. And 10, you have the right to know your rights. I thought it was pretty cool.
All right, Cap. I love him more and more.
Yeah. So he says, I know what my purpose is. I know what my goal is. My conviction is that in that is strong enough that it doesn't matter what anybody says because I know it's right. And I feel the fact that 100 kids would come out here on a Saturday morning on their free time to do this early in the morning, that shows that they believe in this too. So good for him.
Agreed.
Excuse me. And then we had a quick update about Flint. You remember we had reported that a local judge had stopped them, residents, from being able to sue the city of Michigan. And this was turned over in the Court of Appeals. Excuse me. And they ruled that the citizens can sue the state and state officials because of the water crisis. So we'll see what happens coming from that.
Well, I hope it turns into a lot. They certainly have a variety of legislative, civil, and other cases I think they can be brought. I hope that it cannot be brought.
Yeah.
At a minimum, to get the fucking shit fixed. Just get the infrastructure, you know.
I think I tweeted yesterday, it was like 407 days since the governor has known about the crisis, and still people in Flint do not have clean water coming out of their taps. So it's like, I don't, and that's another point where it's like, you know, there were no mass, you know, demonstrations in Flint, you know, and that's about water and the environment, but yeah. It's seen differently, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, you're right about that.
Yeah.
So. You're right. Are you sure you're doing okay?
Yeah, let's keep going. Let's see how
we're in the pipe. 5 by 5.
As he says, keep it going. Keep it going.
Put the game clock at 4:20.
Smoke weed every day.
Ozzy, 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 oi, oi, oi. Australia legalizes growing of medicinal marijuana crops once and for all. Mm. The benefits of medicinal marijuana have been extolled by U.S. residents for a while, and now it's Australia's turn. After passing legislation in February, this Sunday saw the Narcotic Drug Amendment Bill come into being, meaning people and organizations in Australia are now able to apply for a license to cultivate and manufacture medicinal cannabis in Australia.
Oh, right, in Australia.
Yeah. So that's, I guess, one more country down. Yeah. And, you know, and I feel like, you know, you and I were having this conversation the other day about here in the United States. Because I think in 2 days or 3 days on Tuesday, 5 more states will have legalization.
6 more states,
could have.
They not won't, but it's on the ballot.
Yeah, I have on the ballot the possibility of legalization within those states. And if they all went, they'd be like, you know, 20%, 25%.
25% of all,
you know, a quarter of all you know, citizens now live in a state that has legalized weed.
And if you expand that to include medical states like Michigan, the number becomes almost 50%.
Exactly. So you start to ask yourself, like, well, why is it criminalized federally still? What's with the, you know, why is it on this level and that level? So a lot of the places, like when we lived in Argentina, they went and made it an amendment to the Constitution. So, like, you know, you have, like, you can't be discriminated on this, that, or the other thing. Like, nah, you can grow and have weed and nobody can tell you otherwise, period.
So that's the system.
Is that me?
Is that you?
No, it's not me.
Okay.
But so I do like Australia's doing it as a amendment, you know, as changing the bills and stuff. I think that's what we need to do, right? So it's a Schedule One drug, marijuana is, and that's going to have to change at some point.
Yeah,
you know, for actual, even if it's legal in Colorado, like you could be, you know, federally busted for it in a variety of ways. People in Colorado are still in jail because of weed. Like there's, you know, it's not. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it's not decriminalized and constitutionally allowed in the way that it should be.
Yeah, I hear you on that.
And even like you say here, we're in a medicinal state, Michigan, but it still has a real kind of like dirty vibe to it. Not like I mean, more like I guess people like how they think and talk and just the sort of general attitude. It's shifting. It's shifting, but I do feel like there's still a, I don't know, like not a. Like in Colorado, it felt like, because it's legal there, it felt very just like, nah, no big deal, like whatever, like this is just like, you know, nothing. It didn't seem like anything or anything. Whereas here, it's not like that, I guess, yet, because it's not legalized, it's medicinal. But I feel like people still have like there's a general like connotation surrounding marijuana that's not necessarily changed fully. But
I disagree.
Right.
I just feel like the people we know and all sorts of like socioeconomic levels and also they all are very like, yeah, of course people smoke weed. like, it's not a big deal. Like, so many people.
I'll say this.
People of all ages, everything.
If you were to chart, like, the number of, like, cultural marijuana references on TV, holy crap.
Well, that's not a local thing. I'm talking about
here. I know. I'm just saying, just, you know, as another data point.
Yeah, there's like two TV shows right now that are about selling pot legally. So
no, I'm talking about other shows where they're smoking.
But I'm saying that there's actually two shows on television about that. So
true.
Yeah, I think that's definitely very different.
Speaking of weed and legally and blah, 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 blah. Bad thoughts, I don't want to hear any more of that song.
Yeah, fuck that song. So 2 years after Ferguson, Missouri cops are accused of shaking down the poor. This is from Vice News. 2 years after the feds decried a system of preying on the desperate to fund the local government, in Ferguson, Missouri, being poor can still get you locked up in the state. Or so says a new lawsuit filed in federal court Tuesday. Plaintiffs allege the St. Louis County city of Maplewood uses jail time to squeeze poor people for money, and that in a more extreme move, the local government effectively denies people access to court if they're in debt.
Yeah, and that's not a, I'd say like a well-known, but like this, the period of time before you're convicted of a crime, when you're just accused of a crime, right, and you get brought into jail.
You're arrested.
Mm-hmm. You have to bond your way out. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have sufficient money, and like, this is a very, like elitist, classist thing to think this way. But there are a lot of individuals in our country that, you know, they're one disaster, one medical catastrophe away. And think about being in jail and needing $500 to $1,000. There are many individuals that couldn't come up with $500,000 on the hop right there to get out of jail. So now you're going to be in jail waiting your trial. Mm-hmm. This can go on for months. Over $1,500.
Yeah.
Months. And at one point, you're just like presented with a DA or someone's like, hey, listen, you've been in jail for 7, 12, 14 days. You've already lost your job and your family's already fucking pissed at you and blah, 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 blah. Why don't you just sign this thing? It doesn't really say you're guilty, but it doesn't say you're innocent either. And we'll let you out of jail. Yeah. Oh, but you got to go on probation and you're going to have to pay all this money to be on probation. Yep. You're going to do all this fucking shit and we're going to have all these rights taken away from you because now you're a criminal and you've got all this, you know, thing that goes against you. But it's either that or you can stay in jail for another month until your trial comes along. They use this as leverage.
This takes it even further than that, because what they're doing here is they're literally denying you access to data about your case until you pay.
Yeah, a price per sheet just to be able to fucking like...
No, you're talking again about bureaucratic stuff. I'm literally talking about this is a peculiar scheme, extortion scheme, the lawsuit says, that poor people accused of failing to appear in court are forced to pay a fee of between $300 or $500 or serve jail time in order to have their warrant recalled or even to just access the court system. People facing such warrant bond fees are allegedly denied basic information about their case or an opportunity to appear before a judge until they have paid up or spent 48 hours in jail.
Wow. So I bet you this is information you could get under a FOIA request.
Yeah.
And these fucking individuals are being told you can't even see a judge. I bet you can't even log into the fucking system and get a court date or see anything until you pay this fee. If you're dinged, what they're doing is they're basically financially putting a lien on access to information.
Access to the court.
That's unconscionable.
This woman, Cecilia Webb, 26, black and a mother to a 6-year-old, recounted getting caught up in Maplewood's snare on her way to a night shift at Walmart this June. After parking her car, blue vest and name tag in hand, Webb said she discovered the path to work was blocked by a city police officer. Webb was arrested after a brief dispute and sprung from jail only after her husband and pastor managed to find $550 to pay Maplewood for one outstanding arrest warrant and $300 to pay nearby city of Webster Groves for another. It was never really clear why I was arrested, she told Vice. They never told me. They just said, hey, you have to pay this amount of money.
Wow. Webster Groves, Ferguson, fuck all them, dude.
Yeah.
And so really, the DOJ report was pretty scathing that they had been using a arrest and warrant and basically fining the black tax.
Yep.
Right. To the point that there were more bench warrants than there were people in this county, mm-hmm. right? Like, there are emails that had the clerk and the court supervisor high-fiving and congratulating each other on a particularly financially successful day, mm-hmm. declaring that's the most money we've ever made mm-hmm. on black people through court cases and warrants, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're gleefully. It's a line item number two on mm-hmm. their fucking income for the entire city. These people's jobs are funded by doing that shit. And so the DOJ shines a light on that. And now they're doing – I don't say they can't do that. But they're like, okay, all right, listen, guys, we got, you know, more warrants than there are people. Okay, we went a little bit too far. Mm-hmm. Take it down a bit. But guess what? We still need that money. Mm-hmm. The budget didn't change. The fucking – my salary didn't change.
Nope.
We got to make that money. How are we going to do it? Well, we got to figure out a way. Oh, man, we got to feed access to court. We got to put a financial lien on access to information. Wow. And where's mm-hmm. that money come from? Just people just have to pay it. Just have to pay it.
Yep.
And for what? It's just now just...
She didn't even know.
It's just money that just goes.
They just get it. It's just gone. They just get the money.
Mm-hmm. Fuck me, man.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Fuck me. And I, like, really, when you think about just, like, privilege and class and you know, like, I honestly have been pulled over and, like, rolled the window down and, like, what's going on? Like, what's wrong with you? Like, I get, like, indignant with cops. Not, like, as a rule of thumb. Like, I'm not trying to. I have a black woman in the passenger seat now. But, like, I've done that before. Like, literally. And here this individual's getting charged and fined for just going to work.
Yep.
With their fucking name tag and...
Blue vest
for Walmart. Fuck me.
Let's get the pile concert going.
Good night, everybody.
Oh, Jesus. Wait.
Not yet. That's
it, moved,
early.
It moved. That's moved. I moved the buttons. It's been too long since we and we're running out of the clock is ticking.
I know TikTok. So this week or last week actually, President Obama returned to for an all new edition of Mean Tweets on.
Barack Obama is the Nickelback of presidents.
This.
Obama couldn't negotiate getting a Whopper without pickles. At Woodstock Dave. Thanks, Dave. I bet Obama likes mustard on his hot dogs because he's gross. At Duck Punks. Just found out my daughter shares a birthday with Obama. Puke. In cats. At Mom of Four Munchkins. Barack Obama dances like how his jeans look. You know, this jeans thing, this is so old. This was years ago. Come on. My mom bought new conditioner, and it sucks. It isn't even conditioning my hair. I blame Obama. Barack Obama. Bro, do you even lift? Well, I lifted the ban on Cuban cigars. That's worth something. Barack Obama is the... Barack Obama is the Sharknado of presidents. Loud, stupid, and overhyped. Hashtag Sharknado 4. President Obama will go down as perhaps the worst president in the history of the United States! ! At Real Donald Trump. Well, at Real Donald Trump, at least I will go down as a president.
Boom.
Mic drop.
Boom.
The other thing that happened lame duck presidency wise is the White House hosted a princess party for black girls, and it was all about celebrating literacy. There's no limit to what we as women can accomplish. First Lady Michelle Obama reminds everyone at one of the most powerful affirmations of all that the brilliance of women is something that cannot be dimmed in the face of adversity, and there is no limit to what women can continue to achieve. Picture a room full of 115 young black girls proudly wearing sparkly tiaras, repeating the affirmations that they are strong, beautiful, kind, and brilliant. Then they excitedly color in photos of crowns and write their own affirmations as points on the jewels of their crowns. I am smart. I am funny. I am a queen, their pages say. On Monday, October 17th, this powerful scene became a reality when the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans hosted an AFAM Ed Literacy Princess Party to celebrate literacy while reframing narratives around beauty and brilliance for girls of color. I thought that was pretty cool. They're so cute. Nice. Little girls.
Very good.
They're black ass, black, and black stuff.
Doing it up in the White House?
Yes.
So, who is it this wrote us in? They said first email.
And what the f*** are you saying to us?
They said they liked our apology ratings, so we're going to get to it. We're going to rate some apologies.
Got quite a few this week. They're piling up.
So let's start with the 76ers. Mm-hmm. So the 76ers, if you don't know, had a singer named 7 Streeter scheduled to sing the anthem. And a young lady came out, a black woman, wearing a shirt that said, "We Matter." And moments before the anthem.
I just want to stop you there because it literally said, "We Matter."
Yeah, that's it. Okay. That's it.
We didn't even say Black Lives Matter. Said, "We Matter." Okay,
we matter. Yep. And literally like moments before she was set to take the stage, opening season opener, not just any old anthem, like the home opener against the Oklahoma Thunder at the Wells Fargo Center in Philly, was told, nope, you're not going to be able to sing because of the We Matter jersey. Literally, dude. Mm-hmm. And so believe it or not, but the reaction from the players was swift, and they had a meeting, and they voiced their disappointment and displeasure, and they insisted on her being invited back and a rectification of this matter. And so they did. They apologized and invited her back to sing at another time, and so, you know, the players' voices were heard. And so they do have a, I guess this is their apology. This mm-hmm. is from the Sixers.
Let's hear it.
"We are sorry that this happened. After receiving feedback from our players, basketball operations staff, and ownership group, we believe that the wrong decision was made and 7 should have been welcome to sing. We apologize to her, and in an effort to move the conversation forward, we have reached out to her to offer her an opportunity to return and perform at a game of her choice. We are waiting to hear back." Maudlin.
Who made the call? Who are they? Why did they make this decision? Are they going to be held responsible for it? Like, fuck all this other shit. You're sorry? Great. And what are you going to do now? Who made this decision? Why was it made? When was it made? Will this decision not be able to be made in the same fashion again? Like, fuck all. Zero.
Yeah.
Zero.
Brown said the Sixers want to do something responsible and bold. And the players are apparently happy the organization apologized to Streeter and offered her an opportunity to return. We want to say that we apologize. We made a mistake and we want to move on. Do you want to move on?
Interesting. You want to move on. Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, there's nothing even like, we are sorry that this happened. Honestly, someone, I forget who said it on Twitter, but it's really the best response I've heard. They call this the, like, sucks to be you apology. Because really, it's like, you're not apologizing at all. It's like, sucks to be you. Shh, sorry that happened to you. Right. Whew, that sucks. You got egg on your face. Mm-hmm. And it really is. It's like, sucks to be like, up Schitt's Creek without a paddle apology. Like, that's not really an apology. Mm-hmm. Man, fucking sucks to be you. Sorry. Thanks, I guess. I don't know. We are sorry that this happened. I'm sure you are. Mm-hmm. And then it's like this whole, like, after receiving feedback from our players, backs operations, ownership group, we believe the wrong decision. Nothing from 7 at all. No, they didn't mention her name, I guess, to the end. And 7 should have been welcomed to sing. But she wasn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm struggling to give it 1 as well. I guess 0. Half.
Yeah.
The words "we are sorry" is like you. That's like you start really strong. Like, we are. If it just was there, "we are sorry," that would have had like a 4.
That would have been like a 5.
Yes, like a 4. Right? "We are sorry." Like, that's like a 4, but you chipped away at it with all those other bullshit. So I guess half, 0.5.
Mm-hmm.
Who's next on our
list is the director of Doctor Strange. who, now that the movie is out, is addressing a little further the whitewashing controversy. For those who don't know, Doctor Strange features a character called the Ancient One, which in the comic books is an Asian character, and is played by Tilda Swinton in the movie that came out this past weekend.
And if I'm not mistaken, like, Tilda in, like, some kind of, like, gray face makeup, right? Like,
she's, like, fully white, but she's kind of androgynous, so she's just a little, like, there's a gender bendy kind of thing.
That's not like gray face, not black face, I'm sorry, not Asian face, but, like, they paint, like, her character's bald and, like...
Yeah, she's bald. I don't think she's painted anything. Oh, okay. Tilda has played these kind of gender bendy type of...
I see. And is the character, is the comic book character Asian also gender bendy?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a man in the in the comics.
Okay.
So
I wonder why Tilda. I wonder why they made that decision.
Well, they talked about they definitely wanted to make it a woman, and they definitely wanted to make it an older woman because they didn't want it to be like a fangirl, you know, like fanboy, like young person. But then they said, and this is where I feel like it's kind of weird. They said that when they visioned it as an Asian character. When we talked about Asian actors who could do it as we were working on strips, every iteration of it, including the one that Tilda had played. But when I envisioned the character being played by an Asian actress, it was a straight up dragon lady. Like, are you kidding me right now?
So you didn't use an actual Asian actor because of your dragon lady weird bias?
Wow. Yeah, they didn't want to continue the stereotype.
But that was in your mind. Mm. We were on the Reminiscing with Chris, if you're a premium subscriber.
He says, by definition, the dragon lady is domineering, powerful, secretive, mysterious Asian woman of age with duplicitous motives. And I just described Tilda's character. I felt like we would be contributing to a bad stereotype. How lazy is that?
Yeah, I'm just thinking of fucking Matt Damon. Diversity happens.
He says in the process, the director learned a lot about the term whitewashing from an irate Asian community that took the internet to take him and Marvel to task. By the way, it wasn't just Asian people, but whatevs. Excuse me. At the time when casting was happening, there was a lot of anger circulating about female representation, but the term whitewashing wasn't even a term that I knew in the way that it's used now. That's because you dumb. I knew in the classical sense of yellow face of white actors playing Asian characters, so I wasn't as sensitive to that issue. But I was aware that I was erasing a potential Asian role. He says what he did to counterbalance that was reinvented the character of Wong, which is played by Benedict Wong. And they inverted. He was kind of a manservant type of character in the comics. And they made him a master and somebody who helps teach Doctor Strange in this one. And... he says, give credit to... this is in the Daily Beast. Give credit to Derrickson. Excuse me. For acknowledging that the very community he was trying to avoid offending is the one most justifiably set at the erasure, and that trading one underrepresented on-screen minority for another is far from an ideal solution to correcting entrenched racism in any property being given the blockbuster treatment. Quote, diversity is the responsibility of directors, and I took that as seriously as I could, he said. Whitewashing, if you use the term the way it's used now, is what I did with the role, but it also implies racial insensitivity and it implies racist motives, and I don't think I had either. I was really acting out of what I still feel is the best possible choice. But it's like I chose the lesser evil, and just because you choose the lesser evil, it doesn't mean you're not choosing an evil, end quote. The vocal opponents, upset over two vocal opponents, he says, I don't feel that they're wrong, he says, sympathetic. I was very aware of the racial issues that I was dealing with, but I didn't really understand the level of pain that's out there for people who grew up with movies like I did, but didn't get to see their own faces up there, end quote. He offered an antidote to the evasiveness that greets most complaints when studio products are hit with critiques of cultural appropriation, ownership of the creative choices he made, and the negative ripple effect they may have on the culture by virtue of the enormous reach of the MCU. So rarely do filmmakers comment on their own controversies, let alone agree with their critics from within the heavily fortified Disney Marvel machine, that Derek's candor itself feels like progress. Quote, he says, the angry voices and the loud voices that are out there, I think, are necessary. And if it pushes up against this film, I can't say I don't support it, because how else is it going to change? This is just the way we've got to go to progress, and whatever price I have to pay for the decision I've made, I'm willing to pay, end quote. So what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, what is he going to pay? The movie's made, it's out, like,
well, I think he's trying to say, like, you know, he was looking to do a $70 million opening weekend for the movie, and he may still do that, or did he do that? I don't even know.
I think he did. It was okay. Big.
you know, I don't know. I think one thing is, like, I'm happy to hear a director actually talking about it after the fact. Like, I feel like a lot of them, like, just don't even address it at all.
Like, that's the who we just talked about the other weekend, the Edward Scissorhands.
Right, and, Tim Burton.
Yeah, Tim Burton's like, oh, I'm not going to talk about that.
Right.
I don't have black people in my movie, whatever.
Yeah. Like, so, okay. So there's that part of it. But I also don't think it's, I think it's, like, a very, let's say, like, cerebral response. You know what I mean? Like, there's very little, like, emotion in there. And I think it's hard for people of color to hear that, because it's easy for white folks to take this in some sort of, like, you know, intellectual exercise and thinking about their decisions.
It does have an air of, oh, I didn't know blackface was offensive.
Like,
sorry.
Literally. Like oh, but, I just thought if I just cast a white woman, everything would be cool. Like, what?
I increased the number of lines that the other Asian man has.
And I just don't even understand, like, so your response to the potential of a role seeming stereotyped is not to write a more nuanced, detailed, and
better character.
And deeper, yeah, you know, a delved into character for a person of color. It's just make it a white woman and then it's all good.
And, like, that's why I said that his issues, the bias is in his head.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, they're not in his head. You're right, this dragon lady trope exists.
Of course it does.
And you're right, this character has elements of that. Like,
but he
change
the one
it.
That was going to make it come alive.
Change,
like,
it.
Like, don't
film
make it
differently.
That, cool.
You know, add some new dialogue. I think you could, with two scenes and less than, like, you know, four lines, have given that character enough depth to avoid the, like, dragon lady trope.
Yes. Anyways.
It is very strange. I can't think of another.
No pun intended.
Example. But it's like, you know, like, you've got to. You know, like, you've written Gone with the Wind, and you've got the, mm-hmm. What's the aunt, the woman that won the Academy Award, May, is that her name?
Who are you talking about?
In Gone with the Wind, the black maid or servant.
Was oh, the person that paid Mammy and Gone with the Wind.
Mammy, thank you. She was, like, the first Academy Award nomination mm-hmm. for a black. Right, so you've got this movie.
Hattie McDaniel.
So, right, you've got this movie, and it's got a character that's like, well, wait a minute. This is kind of, it's not exactly, you know, the greatest thing. It's tropey and this and that. But we're going to get Hattie. You could do things. You could, you know what I'm saying? Like, the solution would have been for Gone with the Wind to make Hattie McDaniel a, like, white dude. I just don't understand how that would have been, like,
well, I don't
the
really,
choice.
I don't know if I see a good correlation there.
There isn't a good correlation. It's too bizarre.
It's not just too bizarre. Just, like, you don't have the opportunity to rewrite Gone with the Wind. But this is a fucking comic book, and you already did rewrite the character. You made it a completely different gender and a completely different race. So if you are already taking such liberties, you could have done You could have done anything.
That's what I'm hitting. The liberties that the director took were pretty big.
They were wide.
They were really big. Like, if you were going to do that, like, just make it less dragon lady-ish.
Yeah.
I don't understand the... Or you really... And I think...
So what are you grading it?
Between the lines. Like... I guess before I grade it, I think between the lines, what this director is saying is that he didn't know or think or didn't have Asian characters and actors he wanted to hire.
Which is ironic when you're writing... When your source material is so steeped in racist stereotypes, generally speaking. So, like... You can't acknowledge the fact that you knew that this stereotype was going to be something you had to deal with and then be like, but I didn't really go all the way there.
Right.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Okay, so because there was some, like, post-analysis, but I don't want to get caught. Like, when Nate Parker had his Ebony interview, I immediately was like, well, there was some good post-analysis. And then after some more thought, I was like, wait a minute. He didn't even reference her name.
Nope.
Like, there's a lot of pieces missing.
Yeah.
So I felt like, in the same sense, like, my initial, like, well, that sounds like a two or a three. There's some good post-analysis.
Mm.
But because of the, it again, feels, it's like it's a more nuanced version of Sucks to Be You.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I know this was terrible and I was really fucked up and I did this thing, but I want to make a lot of money. So I guess maybe like 1.5.
Mm. I don't even know if it was a real apology. It just was like justification.
Yeah, maybe it was an explanation.
So, an explanation and like, I'll take my lumps. But like, bitch, you're not taking any lumps at all. You literally, your lumps are having to do this interview? Fuck
was
off.
The word apology or
no,
sorry in there?
No,
then it's
he
a
gets
zero.
A zero.
Yeah, it's a DQ.
Zero.
You're right. It's an explanation after the fact, which really is an excuse.
I appreciate his explanation and I appreciate the conversation. But yeah, no, you don't get any points for that. Okay, last one. And actually, let me stop here and just mention, my voice sounds a little different
now.
You do.
Now. Sound a little bit a little healthier.
We had to actually stop. I was coughing up a literal lung. And stop, and that's why the show is super late. Apologize, but
there might be some discordant, weird business because we recorded pre 2:04. The first hour was recorded Sunday.
Sunday, right?
Was it Sunday?
Mm-hmm.
Sunday.
And I couldn't, I just couldn't make it. I couldn't make it through.
And here we are Tuesday.
Yeah.
And it'll get posted today. But so there's things like, you know, oh, we haven't voted, but then we just voted. So
yeah.
Sorry.
Anyway, sorry. I just was too sick to continue talking on air. So,
hey, you know what? It's free, the podcast.
True.
And you could leave a 5-star review that might make Leslie feel better.
Might.
Might make your cold go away faster.
Might. I'm still a little coffee. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was from Very Smart Brothers, who we frequently cover on the show.
Yes.
But last week, they posted something by Panama Jackson, a piece entitled Male Birth Control Trials Halted Because Side Effects. Good.
Panama. Side effects good? I'm confused why that's good.
Let me let him get into it. So the piece itself goes into a very long drawn out as to why, you know, it's good that they were halted. He says, I'm just read a few quotes about why. He says, sounds reasonable to me. I don't want to be subjected to any of those side effects. It's bad enough I have to deal with some of those as a teenager, but now, fuck it, that. I mean, who would want to deal with that? And he talks about some of the different articles and different side effects that came along with this male contraception. Keeping in mind, most of them, almost all of them, are currently being experienced by women who are taking birth control. 55% of us between 25 and 29 are on birth control and having these same side effects, but whatever.
And never to mention that somewhat monthly without birth control, PMS can be like debilitating. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like there's aside from the pill side effects, there's menstruation side effects, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he said a few things in the article. I'm just going to read a few little choice things. He said, I realize some women take birth control for medical purpose, and well, that sucks for you since I suppose your options are limited. He said, fuck that. Patriarchy is a bitch, but the status quo seems to be working out okay for now, B. Mm-hmm. Demand a better pill with less side effects, or at least with minimized side effects, and then we can all win together.
Yeah, and I like him, but the entire article's off. The tone is off.
All of it was off. I literally was reading it. I kept waiting for, like, the joke to come in. I kept waiting for him to be like, now that's what I would have sound like if I was a fuckboy. Like, I kept waiting for there to be a, like, ha, 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 this is what I've been hearing men saying. It's so fucked up. And it was like, oh, no, he's actually saying this bullshit.
You remember the piece we did where there's an apology from the NFL team? I can't remember who it was. It was like, maybe the Rams or somebody. They had like a women's day, right? They were going to have women come to the...
Oh, it was University of... It was UT, I think.
Yeah, but so their fucking program was like so gross. You know, like grab the balls, get under this, stay on all fours, and this and that. And I remember we talked about like, how did this fucking happen? Like what happened? And I don't know the description. There's probably some like scientific term for it, but like you have this like fuck-ass thought and you don't have the lens or the time, or no one sort of interjects at that moment. And then it kind of snowballs. And then before too long, it's like, wait a minute, we've got a whole women's day thing. And we're talking about like grabbing by the balls and shit. Right. And I don't know, but maybe that this was the same kind of thing. Like, wait, I read this thing about male birth control and side effects, and I have an opinion, an idea, and I'm gonna start writing about it. And now as I'm writing about it, I'm in my voice and in my head in this sort of like sardonic tone. And then I write the whole thing in that way without realizing like, whoops, wait a minute, this is completely off base. And I'm not making excuses, justifying, but like, I believe everyday feminism, or was it the establishment? I don't want to blame Ijeoma, but one group did an article about, I think it was like equitable pay or something else. And then there was backlash. They tried to fix it. And then they like, okay, wait a minute, you're right.
It wasn't the establishment, but go on.
It wasn't Ijeoma, it was everyday feminism. But it was in the same sense, like this happened. And then it was like, wait a minute, we got to kind of rethink our thinking and like, oops, the whole thing shouldn't have been done. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where, is it Leonard, Very Smart Brothers?
It's Panama.
Panama.
Jackson.
Panama Jackson. I don't know where he's at with that. What?
Well, we're talking about his apology, so let's get to that.
Okay.
So he published, obviously there was considerable backlash. I posted about it. Ronnie Dean Byrne posted about it. A bunch of us posted about it. Just like, what the fuck, dude? Like, we support your platform all the goddamn time. So many of us share Very Smart Brothers. I love Damon. He's, you know, super smart. But this shit was stupid and just offensive and horrible. So he, Panama, the next day said, let's go ahead and talk about that birth control piece. I'm going to read the whole thing.
Okay.
He says, yesterday I wrote a piece entitled Male Birth Control Trials Halted Because of Side Effects. Good. where I discuss recent reports that trials have been halted for what is an effective injection of for males that could serve as an additional alternative on the birth control market. But between some indefensible statements and some horrible phrasing, well, let's just say that things got bad fast. For instance, I said this. I realize some women take birth control for medical purposes, and well, that sucks for you since I suppose your options are limited. Now, that statement by itself is dismissive. I see that. It's also rude. It is also not what I meant to say, at least not in that fashion. I do think that it sucks that many women who have to take birth control for medical purposes have very little options, and often that option comes with a side of pain and suffering. It doesn't, quote, suck for you as the rest of us move on with your lives because we don't have that problem, but obviously that's effectively what I wrote. That was no bueno. I also said in reference to not willingly signing up for a method that might have some side effects I find displeasing. Quote, fuck that. Patriarchy is a bitch, but the status quo seems to be working out for now, B. Even as I typed that again, I had to cringe at just how ridiculous a statement that is. Also, that couldn't be further from how I feel. I don't believe that patriarchy as a status quo is okay. I'm fortunate enough to have enough women in my household and as friends who are quick to chin check me when an opinion of mine sway too far from common sense. Obviously, I'm a human. Mistakes will happen, but having people help you see through them is always a win, especially when it comes to empathy and trying to understand what things are like for women. The Very Smart Brothers community also is a big win in that department. Quote, demand a better pill with less side effects, or at least with minimized side effects, and then we can all win together. We'll just call this uninformed and unresearched and, well, plain stupid. Look, I know that women have been complaining about birth control since the beginning. Anybody with half a brain wouldn't assume women haven't been hoping for and demanding a better solution or form of birth control. But alas, I said it anyway. There are other examples, but you get the point. The worst part is that I know what I wrote doesn't even reflect my true opinions. For instance, I absolutely think there should be a male form of birth control. And if a viable option were present, I'd be inclined to give it a try. I'm not overly concerned about side effects since, you know, drugs and shit. And I do believe in sharing the burden of birth control in whatever capacity is possible. Which gets to another point. I tried to tell women how to fix their own problems with birth control. Le sigh. That, as they say, wasn't very smart. I'm not perfect and I never will be. I'm able to learn from my mistakes as every moment is a teachable one if you're open to it. Thanks to a fun round of comments near and far, I did that. Instead of saying, fuck it, that's how I feel, I decided that everybody can't be wrong. Maybe it's me. And because I'm fairly self-aware, it didn't take long to see where I zigged when I should have zagged. So I apologize for being so cavalier and tone deaf with an issue that obviously is of great import to women and honestly men too. And having a group of people, in this case women, who can read your works and see them for what they are and let you know, nah, B, that ain't it, is important. So lesson learned again. Life is evolution and nobody is ever going to get it right all the time. But calling out nonsense means it can happen to you, me, as well. And I'm okay with it. I like the challenge of unlearning old habits, even if it comes from a pretty significant roast. Nobody speaks in a vacuum, so the back and forth to me is a win. Very Smart Brothers is about the conversation of it all, and sometimes that convo goes left when it should go right. But as long as we're here, we're talking, there's an opportunity for education, and that's the win. Teachable moments should equal higher learning, which I learned today.
Okay. I would say very rife with analysis, right? Like post-analysis. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking at our 7 criteria of what constitutes an apology.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he expressed regret.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of, but not specifically. Definitely explain what went wrong. You know, I think that, it sounds like what I said went wrong. Almost like you start going down this like, oh, let's talk about like locker room talk and like blah, 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 blah. And like, wait a minute, how did we get to this really like ridiculous place? Definitely, I think, acknowledge responsibility. I mean, how could you not? He wrote it. So he did that. I didn't really hear repentance, didn't hear any offer of repair, didn't really hear any actual apology or request for forgiveness,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately heard a little bit of the like, at least I started this dialogue. And
which pisses me off to no end. My thing is this. First of all, this entire thing is bullshit, like full on. Like, he gets like negative 10 for me. And I told a bunch of women I was going to talk about this because some people accepted it graciously and some people were like, nah, B, fuck that.
He didn't say sorry. He apologized for himself being cavalier. That's like, you know, like I shoot a gun in a crowd and I kill somebody. I shoot him in the head. I'm like, I'm sorry. I was so cavalier with that firearm. Right. That's not really an apology.
Right. There's a few places where I think it went left, for to use his own vernacular, in the quote unquote, you know, let's talk about this. One is, of course, what you mentioned already, which is the, like, at least I started a dialogue. Bitch, nobody needed this dialogue. So don't pat yourself on the back for starting some fuck shit dialogue that you shouldn't have even had in the first place. Secondly, this, like, this entire point where he talks about, let's just chalk this up to not doing research. Are you a writer or are you not a writer? You don't get to write some shit about a actual issue that's in the news and then be like, oh, I didn't even research it. I just put my fuck shit opinion out there with no context whatsoever. That's egregious. That's beyond even, like, that apology needed to be, like, very specific and deliberate in that piece right there.
And maybe this is on your list, but now as you're saying this, I'm kind of like putting the two side by side. His explanation for the line patriarchy's a bitch, but the status quo is working. There is no explanation for that. Like, nope. You say that's not how you think, but that's what you wrote.
But it is how you think. And that's the other thing, is he keeps continually saying, I wrote this stuff, I don't even believe it. Bitch, I don't believe you.
Who's the
I don't believe you. You fuck shit. And also, let me just say, when you have in your bio, Panama Jackson is a pretty fly and gorgeous for a light guy, nah, B, nah. You also spelled out the word I-E-Y-E in your original post. That's another fucking red flag. So
why is that? I don't know that.
Oh, that's some hotepy bullshit. They always be writing
I'm laughing. It was like two or three Super Bowls ago. I think it was a Seahawks and 49ers. I can't remember whom, but a cornerback or defensive back on one of the teams made a really homophobic statement about Sam in the locker room. And remember, Sam was the first gay.
Right. Yeah.
And it was like, I don't want that shit in my locker room. Blah, blah, blah. Like, horrible. Come right before the Super Bowl, like, you idiot. And then at the Super Bowl, like, Andrew Kramer, somebody's like, it's like, well, you know, that's not really the way I think, but those are the words that came out of your mouth. I don't understand. That's not an excuse. That's not an explanation even. That's a bullshit, like, one of my friends is black.
That,
like,
to me, those are the thing. That is the one thing that just makes it, like, not even an apology, is that you literally are trying to, your apology includes some sort of notion that the things you wrote are not the way you think. You don't get to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I always say, what you think is what you say. What you say is what you do. What you do is who you are.
Yeah.
Right? That's how it defines you. And if you're a writer and you have a platform and you write, and writing is what you are, it's hard to say, if you wrote and published this, that you didn't think and say and write and do those things.
No, I mean, he got in his feels because he was like, I'm male and I don't need to have these side effects. Y'all women, y'all been putting up with this shit, and that's your fault. That's what he wrote, and that's what he was thinking, and he never acknowledged that that's how he thought and continues to think, because he hasn't dissuaged me of
all. My comment was, the whole thing was shouldn't have been done. And he says, I zigged when I should have zagged.
You shouldn't have had an fucking opinion about
shouldn't
this.
Shouldn't have put pen to
and
paper.
If you had an opinion, your opinion should have been, wow, this is fucked up that we are seeing this response to men dealing with shit that women have been complaining about for millennia. And I'm not even going to get into the long tail, like, reality of the birth control industry, which is that when women who were on trial said, nah, fuck this, B, we out, because this shit is not right, they went and gave it to prisoners, mostly prisoners, black women, who were tested on in prisons while they were incarcerated to get birth control even on the market in the first place.
Yeah.
So fuck all that bullshit. You can go do all of that research too, motherfucker, before you come start talking about that's not how you think.
And you can even go more meta. Why is it 2016 before there's been any discussion or even FDA trial of a male birth control?
Yeah.
Why? No one's ever fucking once thought about or tried male birth control. It's always been women. You know what I mean? That there's something there too. I don't know him personally, and we have shared stuff before, and I don't know what this means for your engagement with his platform, but I think that's another maybe DQ. I think it's more of an explanation than an actual. It was weird. And it's just like Nate Parker. A lot of analysis and explanation, but not the right tone of contrition.
He literally mansplained his mansplaining. Like, literally, that's what his apology was. And so. And that might be the title of this episode now.
Mansplaining
the mansplain. So, yeah. That's...
How about mensplaining mansplaining?
Ugh, horrible.
Mensplain mansplaining.
Yeah. Like, just ridiculous. All right, cool.
So that's a DQ as well?
Yeah, for sure.
You said negative 10, I think.
Yeah, like, literally. Fuck that dude. Mm. All day. And that apology, or whatever the fuck it was supposed to be.
The fuck?
Yeah. All that. Mm-mm. So, oh yeah. Banana.
This was
a sad day. Vine, Twitter has ceased and desist with the Vine platform. Now, old Vines will continue to be there, but no new Vines will be created moving forward. And I mean, I know you're a big fan of the Vine.
Yeah, can I even say this is funny? I use an app to edit and upload my Vines because I find the Vine tool frustrating. You have to like nail the 6 seconds exactly right, you know? So that app stopped working like a month ago. I'm sure they disengaged the API.
Oh, definitely.
And I couldn't figure it out. I'm like, why isn't this? I can't get this app to work. Oh, I can't get my app. What's going on with this app? But like, nope, it was fucking Vine.
No doubt.
I saw a tweet, so I can't take credit for this, but it's like, you know, Twitter, oh man, our platform is just something's not right. It is rife with hate and vitriol and all kinds of just horribleness. Huh. Vine. Let's kill the looping app. Let's kill the looping video app. Like, huh? Like, mm-hmm. You have That's a horrible problem and your solution is to kill the looping video app?
Whatever. It doesn't make any sense at all.
And I think I saw an article about the death of Vine, and if I can find it, I'll post it to the John notes. But there's a little bit something there about, I'm not saying that Vine was made popular by black people, but marginalized individuals used the most popular Viners were not entrepreneurs. They were like, you know, like early YouTubers, like people made Vine a success through nothing other than their sheer desire, talent, and wit and ability to make witty and, you know, visual juxtapositions with 6 second looping videos. So your entire platform existed and people made money. Like there was monetization, you could get sponsorships and shit. Like, so you had this thing that exists culturally because of a group of kind of like unpaid laborers that are making it, and then you go and fucking like kill it. Worse still, you don't support it, you don't promote it, you don't give new tools. Like, when was the last update fundamentally to the thing that Vine did? Never. You know what I mean? And then it dies, and it's like, you know, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
I just stupid, but anyway. So where are our hashtags?
So that was R.I.P. Vines. You guys can check that out. People were sharing like awesome Vines. I actually did an entire thread of all of your best Vines because I love your Vines. They're so good.
There's my favorite one is from the O.J. Simpson.
Oh, yeah. Black women don't like
black
you.
Black women don't like you.
What? A few people, I laugh at the end of that Vine because I just literally was the funniest shit ever, us playing it over and over again to get the Vine right. And a few people were like, I love the laugh at the end. I'm like, I couldn't help myself. It was just too funny. I think I pulled that one out when people were, I don't know what people were tweeting about. Oh, the Amy Schumer gotta go party or whatever. And I was like, I missed the party last night, but let me contribute this Vine because
black women don't like you,
bitch. Anyways, Beyonce CMA was also trending. Beyonce was on the CMAs. Of course, there's been a whole host of shit that happened afterwards, including the CMAs erasing all evidence of Beyonce from their social media platforms.
Can we talk about
that?
Like,
yeah, let's do it.
I can't get over it, right? So that what happened is they announced she's going to be on the VMAs. They do it in typical Beyonce fashion, like 5 days before the VMAs. And she does her daddy issues. Is that the name for
Daddy Lessons?
Daddy Lessons. Song, very country song. She fucking crushes it. Does it with the Dixie Chicks who've been performing it.
Let me stop you there because one of the things I like to point out about the Dixie Chicks piece is that the Dixie Chicks have been like, you know, they've been vilified and kind of blackballed in
since the Bush.
Country music since the whole Bush incident. And the Dixie Chicks, Natalie Maines in particular, was like, yeah, we never thought we'd perform on the CMAs again. And we only got to perform because Beyonce insisted that we perform with her. So there's that.
There's that. Start with that. Start with that. Y'all's former favorite trio, White Girls, are only there because of Beyonce. But so she does all the things she does that are amazing. Has the single, the version of that with the Dixie Chicks ready on iTunes that fucking night. Like, you know, all the stuff you expect her to do. And I don't know, but I could almost guarantee you could chart social media mentions, call it like the Q score. How much are people interested in talking about the CMAs, right? And obviously people aren't buying tickets, but you know, there's an assumed Nelson number. You're going to have a viewership. There's a historical viewership. I guarantee you, the second they announced her, the number of engagements and comments and social media chatter about the CMAs quad fucking drupled and into a demographic they never get, right? I also guarantee you that the CMAs that night, that hour, had a viewership spike that they have almost never seen. Mm-hmm. These things, absolute. There's just, I don't have to fucking look at the data. I don't have to think about it. Garen fucking teed. They had her there for that reason, right? Like, that was the purpose.
Literally.
That was the purpose, to do those things. So why? Why would you erase her performance, all her tweets, all her comments, everything from your social media channel? And we know the answer. We know the answer. Mm-hmm. Because country music media fans, largely white and male, had a backlash at seeing Beyonce on their precious little awards show. And they kowtowed. They fucking kowtowed to white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, you say this all the time, that white supremacy knows no logic. It doesn't obey the laws of profit. It doesn't care about anything.
Doesn't care.
So, you know, all these things that I guarantee happened, they're going to, if you are a media, if you're anything and your audience is narrowly defined as like white and male and urban and rural, guess what? That's shrinking. You know what I mean? Like the map has been pretty clear. Like country radio, like your audience is getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. You fucking need to expand into other fucking areas. You fucking need Beyonce.
Mm-hmm.
And then to fucking, and you know you needed Beyonce, you hired Beyonce.
But to me, there's like a deeper part of that, which is this assumption that country music belongs to white people.
Oh, yeah.
And so to me, like this notion that Beyonce doesn't, she doesn't belong on the CMA stage, that's a racist construct in and of itself.
Yeah, there's so many famous black country musicians. I can't remember the one.
Let's be real, y'all stole that too. Like, for real. There ain't shit out here that y'all actually created yourselves. So let's just put that into context. Feminisa Jones wrote an amazing article for Essence this week about the history of black women in country music. And so for me, the perpetuation of this supremacist idea, and that the CMAs has kowtowed to it, it's just this like dovetailing of supremacy bullshit, and it's gross and horrible. That said, definitely check out Beyonce and the Dixie Chicks, because their performance was fire, and Beyonce was doing her best like black country, beautiful alien, I don't even know what. It was amazing. And so definitely check that out.
And I'm telling you, there, I don't know, because I'm not a country music person, but like Aaron Neville, he's country, right? Who was the
guy with the hat?
Cowboy Troy. There are plenty of black country musicians. Maybe they don't get on the CMAs at the last hour. I don't fucking know. But it just, it's so gross. And when it happened, and obviously like I heard about it on Twitter, and like you're seeing all these screenshots, I really was like, that can't be true. I was like, that can't be possible.
And then
like,
it was.
Yeah, really? Why would you pay all the money and all the effort and all the, you know what you had to do to get Beyonce on that show? And then you're just going to delete the fucking tweets? Get the fuck out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, because I didn't read everything about it, but there might have been one of the profiles. No, there was it was country music. It was the handle. It was the CMA's main account. Fuck that shit.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. You've got a better hashtags. I found this one and shared it with you because I thought it was amazeballs. Lego Career 2016.
Yeah, what was that one?
It was that's the patois for, I guess, Let's Go.
Yeah.
But it was all Jamaican youth tweeting their graduations. And nice. Just, it was one of those hashtags that's meant to, like, counter an inappropriate narrative, right? Like, there might have been a hashtag like, this is Africa. And it was like, you know, this is Africa. Like, it's not the fucking, like, you know, deserted, like everyone poverty stricken, like, you know what I mean? Like the Western ideal and concept of Africa is like a really fucked up thought, and it's because of Hollywood and all these other things. So Lego Career was kind of that same thing, I think, just sort of like it was lifting up, right? So as a hashtag, it was just like, this is me, I'm Caribbean, I'm Jamaican, and I've got a degree in engineering, and I'm going off to do this and that. I just thought it was really sweet.
Mm.
Just a lot of awesome, great stuff. Lego Career 2016.
I love it. That's a good one.
Yeah.
And then Hamilton Mixtape. Mixtape came out. Well, actually, it's not out. Pre-order. Two of the songs are available now that you can listen to. Maybe I can play them, actually. But anyways, the mixtape sounds like it's going to be amazeballs and has all sorts of just like ridiculous kick-ass people on it. And I'm super excited for it to come out. I think Lynn shared a screenshot of the full track listing, and it has all people like The Roots are on it and Busta Rhymes is on it. And so they took songs from Hamilton, and then they had, you know, popular people do it. So like Wait For It, Usher does that. Satisfied is Sia featuring Miguel and Queen Latifah, for example. Regina Spektor does Dear Theodosia. Kelly Clarkson does It's Quiet Uptown. That Would Be Enough is sung by Alicia Keys. And then they did have a couple of My Shot, which is featuring Busta Rhymes and Joel Ortiz. Oh crap, they took it down. I guess I can't listen to it.
Oh man,
I guess they must have just done it for the one day. If you do order it though, you get two tracks now, and then I think the rest come out officially I think the end of the month or something like that.
So you know what do they call this, the book, right, for a musical? The
yeah.
So there's the staging, there's the actors, there's different pieces, but like the book is like the music and the words, and that's the script, I guess I'd say. It's unbelievable, Hamilton's book.
Oh, yeah. I listen to it all the time. Oh. Like, literally, every day I listen to it. Its songs are constantly playing in my head.
Yeah.
It's good music, it's so right? Good. It's amazing music, and then the story it tells through it is just... The music is just that good. The performers are that good. The cast recording is amazing.
Yeah.
It's just really, really
there's
good.
There's definitely something, again, like I feel like because it's driving a narrative and a story, you have to have the songs kind of like, there's a song that is the first part and the first act, and there's like, you know, the song that brings all of the first act together in a, or what do you call that? You know what I'm talking about?
Like, yeah.
So, but all the pieces that he has in this are just, they're unbelievable. It is, in my opinion, hands down the best musical book we've seen in the last century. You know, we haven't seen anything this good since I don't know when, but it's incredible. It's it's worth all the accolades. I don't know if it was worth mortgaging your house to see it on Broadway.
Yeah, I don't. Luckily, we didn't have to do that.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. We were smart. We bought tickets 9 months in advance.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. So,
I guess now we got to go on to crappier news, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, wait. That's my old GOP car.
Yeah. You can put that one. I don't give a shit. No, not this thing.
Dominoes, eat me.
That just summates, even the sad, like,
yeah. It's terrible.
So
we should just say this: today is now election day.
It is
the second time we're recording. We just got back from voting. Very busy at our local polling station. Surprisingly, I think the turnout's going to be really high. It took us a while to vote. So
I would say in line waiting to vote were 30 plus people. It was a big number, and then they only had 8 voting stanchions or whatever that is. So it took a bit. It took a bit. And I tweeted this too. Maybe I'm being overly sensitive, but you know how these voting things are always like little old ladies and men that volunteer at it and shit? And that was still the case today. But there was maybe 6 or 7 white people and 2 black women. And all 6 or 7 white people were sitting down behind the table doing the ID checking stuff. Mm. And the 2 black women were standing,
yep,
doing the like scanning of the ballot and the sort of walk around. And again, I don't know how voting, polling, election, volunteering, maybe there's some sort of like I've been here 50 years hierarchy. I don't know. But it just seemed an odd optic. And it definitely, I don't know if you saw, I think you were still voting. The woman that was the black woman that was taking the sheets to scan in, she had an issue. There was a ballot somebody had to like redo or something wrong, and so she had to leave the space, the little scanning thing, and she needed somebody to come like take over. And she asked the like really the very first older white guy that was there,
the one that called you young man.
Yeah. So he's clearly like the election boss, right? He's like the supervisor,
he's like the
or whatever
head dude.
Yeah. So she's like, well, I need you to, you know, take over for a minute so I can do the, you know, go take it. And just the way he kind of like questioned her and made her kind of have to explain it, it was like, dude, stand here for a fucking minute while I can do this other thing. It just gave me an air of, we don't trust these black women to check IDs. That's my job. Mm. Like I said, maybe I'm being overly sensitive. I also thought the demographic mix was, I guess I don't know our neighborhood perfectly well, but it is pretty mixed. And I thought it was a good mix. Maybe over half the folks there were black voting, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, at least half.
Yeah.
But I think
it took us like a half an hour.
Yeah, like I said, we had to stand in line, like, for real, for real.
Yeah, and at least it wasn't, like, lunch or, like, when school lets out. Oh, good Lord. We should stay away from that area. Mm. But so back to politics. And this is actually almost no longer timely, but you and I were talking about the fact that there's hardly any yard signs.
Yeah, yeah.
No candidates.
I noticed that.
Not even, like, down ballot. No. Like, you're not even seeing, like, Phil Scaggs.
Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to claim nobody. Nobody wants anything to do with this shit. It's hilarious.
On This Week Tonight, John Oliver, each week starts, like, and now on to election 2016, as we like to call the fucktastic, horrible, disaster shit show that we all can't wait to end. But so... I guess Trump supporters have been having their yard signs stolen pre-24 and have taken some drastic efforts, which is not surprising, but I'll let Janine Moose do the talking.
Trump signs aren't just being stolen. This one went up in flames, torched by a guy in his underwear in Platteville, Wisconsin.
Jesus.
The sign's owners were burned up, especially when they recognized Mr. Underwear.
Oh.
First of all, the sign's owner, and they went to the person's yard, they, in lieu of the burnt yard sign, they erected a like 8-foot sign. I'm not even kidding, with like 4x4 like fence posts like cemented into the ground. God damn, I hope he loses.
I think that's our neighbor, our tenant.
Now ex-tenant. So many Trump signs are being swiped that yard sign defense techniques are being deployed. Like using bike chain lubricant to make them slippery and messy, or worse yet, try dog poop, or replace your signs with something they can't steal.
Dude wrote Trump into his field. Nice. Giant, like, you know, from an airplane, Trump.
Quality.
Yep.
I'm going to keep cutting it like this till Trump's elected.
An Indianapolis man used fishing wire and string spray-painted green to fasten down his Trump sign.
Yeah, that's not dangerous at all. That's not dangerous at all.
She loses her footing and lost her grip, and she went flying.
When one sign stealer gave up, the owner followed him.
Shoves me with both hands, knocks me down.
Another owner electrified his sign to zap a would-be thief. You hear less about Hillary signs being swiped, though this Florida woman has to bring her signs in at night. And this woman had someone come up to her door.
Why are you voting for that? And she pointed to my sign.
For Clinton.
And I was totally appalled.
Talk about a game of cat and mouse. Imagine using a mouse trap to protect your Trump sign. New Hampshire State Representative Gary Hopper calls sign stealers
the liberal commie scum.
That's a state representative.
Mm-hmm.
And demonstrates with a disclaimer.
But I want to tell you something you shouldn't do.
Don't hook a 6-volt battery up to a mouse trap and then to firecrackers so when someone moves the sign.
Okay, first of all, he says don't do this and has a video showing you how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
State representative. Fireworkers and mouse traps.
But even worse than stealing signs, who would abscond with a cardboard cutout of the Donald? Cut it out, people. This is shocking. Jeannie Moe, CNN.
It's just, thank God it's going to be over today. And I think we've talked about it, and I'm just going to reaffirm here on air. I'm not watching any fucking coverage. I'm not going to sit here and monitor it. I'm just going to wait until it's over. I don't know what your plan is.
I don't know either. I mean, my plan?
For the election coverage. I just remember in 2000 in New Orleans watching until fucking like midnight, 1 a.m,
yeah.
Going through a he won, he lost, this is real. I was in tears. I literally cried. I'm not ashamed to say it. I don't want to do that again.
Yeah, I don't have any plan.
I'm going to take a Xanax and wake up in the morning.
Yeah. And I guess just get stoned. That'll be my plan.
That sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. I did run across this one video, which was talking about the funniest moments from the 2016 campaign. And so I thought I'd play that just because there were some funny moments, even though it's been a shit show, like generally speaking. Hopefully there won't be a fucking ad.
This is going to be so much fun.
I can't wait.
It's going to be really classy.
It's going to be really fantastic. It's going to be you.
Okay, so that's a Ben Carson coming out.
Oh, for fucks.
Not coming out.
Just pause it for a second. That was honestly the funniest fucking thing. I couldn't believe that was a nationally televised debate. The GOP looked like such a fucking disaster.
Like, it literally was no wonder Trump won the nomination. Like, they couldn't even get all of them out on stage in a time.
Well, and it was like, it wasn't that they couldn't go out. Like, Trump stood in the wings because he didn't hear his name, and he's such an egomaniac, he had to hear his name.
And my favorite,
and then he got the end introducing.
Yeah, my favorite was Jeb's face, just like, oh, well, dudes. Like, honestly.
And then they left Kasich off.
Kasich was like, wait. Now everybody's up there. And Chrissy, where's Kasich?
Honest to God, that might be emblematic of the entire GOP party.
Literally.
That's just
the whole party just boom.
Like, you're playing it. Like,
nuclear.
I want to hear like the Benny Hill, like.
I'm cracking the fuck up.
That might have been the funniest moment. The big old, and even the fucking, like, it's not even a funny moment, but like the first two debates, they had to have like the kiddie table, right? Like the pre-debate with the 14 with
Carla Fiorino or whoever the fuck.
14 people that aren't quite good enough to be on the main stage.
I think Beatrice, our dog, was on that particular debate, and
she said woof.
She said,
well, she is a problematic white woman. She'd be
very
perfect.
Problematic.
She'd fit right in on that stage.
Extremely problematic. Okay, so let me get back to the video here. Hopefully it'll play again. Maybe. It's like loading now. Ugh. Shouldn't have pressed that. Oh, God. It started over. Fuck off. When they were announcing Ted Cruz, and then Carla Fiorino fell.
Oh, you know, the Great Recession was caused by too much regulation. You know?
Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
They're showing it now. This is Carla Fiorino, I guess. This is when, I don't know what's going on. There's a bunch of hugging happening with Ted Cruz and her.
And I'm also aware that California has a drought, and so that's why I made sure I brought my own water.
Oh, my God. Dumbass.
I am good at arithmetic.
I wrote the number down. I don't know if it's the right number. Let's try it. 202.
Eat your heart out, Zuckerberg.
And what is Aleppo? You're kidding. No.
Okay.
Oh, the shimmy. Okay. Shimmy. There's Ben still standing back there. There's somebody like pointing to him to go out on stage.
Breathe.
Lion Ted.
Breathe. You can do it. You can breathe. I know it's hard. I know it's hard, but just.
When they're done with the yoga, can I answer a question?
You cannot. I really hope that we don't see yoga on this stage.
Well, he's very flexible, so you never know.
Oh, shit.
This little bird doesn't know it. Oh, my.
Man, them Bernie folks were so hot on that bird.
That's for the whole debate.
Gary Johnson.
Not say anything.
Donald Trump is a jerk.
Stay on point, Donald. Stay on point.
Lillers, release the hounds.
That's Ted Cruz.
Excellent.
Heidly ho, neighbor. Oakley doakley, neighborino.
Still Ted. Here's Ben Carson, still waiting in the wings, by the way, with Donald.
Ma'am, stop pushing this. Stop pushing him.
A lot.
Please clap.
Yes. That's a please clap. That's the only way it could end. It didn't even get like, I was like, some of the other, like, you couldn't put in a soundbite moment, but like fucking Cruz, when he was trying to fucking say that he endorsed the candidate and refused to say Trump's name.
Yeah.
I support the Republican Party and I'm going to support the candidate and the candidate and the candidate. Presidential candidate. Like, he just refuses to like utter his name. When Jeb had to fucking like kiss the ring and he goes, now go get on your little plane.
Yeah. Go get on your little plane now. That was Chris Christie he did
or
that.
Chris Christie, yeah, not Chris
Christie.
Right.
Oh, Chris Christie. We'll have to talk about that in another episode because, oof, that man has fallen off. Let's talk about some other white people.
I hadn't seen someone fall like him in a while.
Ooh, it's bad. It's
white people. I get bullied in school. I can't wait till I'm a cop so I can bully you. White people. Hey,
white people. God damn it. Fucking white people.
So this is actually not as timely. Halloween's over, but a couple of my followers, I'm with her, is sinfile_93. Mm-hmm. And I think it's his daughter, Mortonium, did a little Halloween PSA. And it's Save the White People, a PSA brought to you by the Alliance for Better White People and the Ad Council.
Every year, hundreds of white people are killed needlessly by serial killers, vengeful spirits. Vengeful spirits as serial killers. Their crime? Stupidity.
Freddy Krueger.
Sleeping in haunted houses. Investigating noises. Playing with Ouija boards. Like it's some kind of joke. Like seriously, what the f***? Y'all just want to die.
Lisa, we're live. Live.
Oh. Sorry. I'm Lisa Middlebaum, president of the Alliance for Better White People. And for just 60 cents a day, you can help put an end to these senseless acts. Like when white people hear a noise in the middle of the night and feel the need to goddamn investigate.
Can you
find showing all these horror movies.
What part of your unseasoned psyche thought that shit was okay? Hmm?
You said unseasoned.
We need your help.
Don't even get me started on these clowns, bruh. Like, I'm getting so sick of this shit.
Especially her.
Come up in my neighborhood with that shit. Like, swear to God, you will leave in a fucking body bag, motherfucker. Like, I am getting so sick of this shit. Like, there is no helping white people. Don't waste our money. Like, seriously, don't. Mm-mm. They ain't gonna ever go on. Yeah, no. Nah, bye. Bye.
Your unseasoned psyche.
Mm-mm.
I love to hit Sarah McLachlan in the background. And you and I, every time we watch one of these movies, you're just like, what is wrong with you people? Like, we were watching, I think it was Fear the Walking Dead, the very first episode, where it's like, yo, it's a fucking, like, crack house, like, church that's been burnt out with, like, bodies in it, and it's 2 a.m. and you're investigating? What's wrong with you? Why would you do that? Like, there's, you don't need that. Go. Leave.
Yep. So I also white people doing white people things. So you know a bodega cat, right? You know what a bodega cat is?
Of course.
Okay. So
I hang out in New York.
As neighborhoods get gentrified, white people come in, and a Yelp reviewer named Diana D was shamed across the internet Tuesday by New York City's powerful bodega cat lobby after Twitter personality Sin Cammy outed her for talking smack on the cat who lives at the SK Deli Market on 2nd Avenue. Quote, Cammy wrote, "You gotta be a miserable, gentrified-ass bitch to yelp about the bodega cat." She gave the bodega a 1-star because she said, "I ordered from SK before and the sandwiches are pretty good. Today, however, I decided to stop in and grab a sandwich. To my dismay, there was a cat perched upon some cases of Budweiser in the middle of the store."
She took a picture, too. Hmm? Like, look at this cat.
Besides being allergic to cats, I wonder what the health codes say about this.
Honest again. That's just like you've come into New York and now you're trying to, like, you know what it is? We've talked about this before. Like, when Americans in particular, white Americans, go on vacation, they like want to make the vacation place like America.
Yes.
Like, I want to go to France.
Like,
and
they want to gentrify.
Yeah.
Like,
and you and I, when we go, we're the exact opposite. I want to have the, like, local experience. Like, you tell me what it's like. I'll eat the food you eat. I'll go to the places you eat. Like, that's why I'm here. Like, I don't want to go to, like, Italy and have, like, a burger and fries from fucking the Hard Rock Cafe. No thanks, you know? Mm-hmm. But that's what these Yelp, this person's kind of, like, acting like. Like, I've come all the way to New York and my health coach said, this is not Whole Foods. You're right. It's not. It's a bodega. And guess what? There's a lot of rats. You want that cat there. Trust me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that in a bad way. New York's just fucking big and tunnels and trash and rats fucking thrive there.
Yes.
A bodega, I don't want to say I'd rather a bodega have a cat, but, like, I'm okay with a cat.
Yeah. Beyond that, the bodega cat serves a purpose. This is New York City. There are rats. You have a cat in a bodega so that you don't have rats in
That's
your fucking bodega. So it's like, I don't even, would you rather see the rats, ma'am?
That's my point.
I don't even understand, like, ugh, I just, fucking white people. Go ahead and play it.
It's too much.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't ready. I didn't even want to get it in, too.
No.
God damn it. Fucking white people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I did want to, I'm going to skip this hidden history piece, Drew, but I do want to talk about this dope black girls, because Roxane Gay put out a list of 13 rules for female friendship, and I thought it'd be interesting to just go through them. I thought some of them are funny, obviously, and, you know, she's author of Bad Feminist and soon to be author of, I believe, another book for Black Panther as well. Very exciting stuff and all of that, and she's brilliant, blah, blah, blah. So she talks about a few of these. I won't read through all 13 of them, but I thought they were pretty funny. So the first one was, abandon the cultural myth that all female friendships must be bitchy, toxic, or competitive. This myth is like heels and purses, pretty but designed to slow women down. So that's a good one. Two, a lot of ink is given over the mythologizing. What is that word?
Mythologizing.
That. Female friendships as curious, fragile relationships that are always intensely fraught. Stop reading writing that encourages this mythology. Because actually none of my female friendships are like that. So that's a really good one. If you're the kind of one who says, I'm mostly friends with guys, and act like you're proud of that, like that makes you closer to being a man or something and less of a woman, as if being a woman is a bad thing, see item 1B. It's okay if most of your friends are guys, but if you champion this as commentary on the nature of female friendship, well, search your soul just a little bit. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. I haven't been that woman, so, but I get that. I hear it all the time, though. What do you think when you hear a girl say that? Like, all my friends are guys. I can't be friends with women.
I've known a couple women like that, and I've known one woman like that.
Yeah.
And she was,
let me ask you this, was she a whore? Or?
Yeah, I was going to say promiscuous.
Oh, well, there you go.
I don't like that word, but, she was, I should say her issue with being friends with other women is because she probably was stealing guys or something. I don't know.
Well, I don't know.
She,
well, a lot of times I feel that that's like always thing where they like, they'll like subjugate women in favor of like a male perspective often. And it doesn't play well with other women because we see through the bullshit and we're like, bitch, you ain't shit. So
yeah,
miss me with that. And also just this idea of garnering male attention a lot of times. And that's not to say there are plenty of people that do have a lot of guy friends for plenty of reasons. And also, you know, we can talk about how gender is non-binary. And so there's plenty of room for all types of friendships along all sorts of gender lines. However, that using that as some sort of badge, it always just like strikes me like totally like uncomfortably wrong and all of that. And all of my oldest friends are women, so I don't know how that would even work, but that's I guess whatever. Want nothing but the best for your best friends, because when your friends are happy and successful, it's probably going to be easier for you to be happy. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Number 6, tell your friends the hard truths they need to hear. They might get pissed, but it's probably for their own good. Once my best friend told me to get my love life together and demanded an action plan, and it was irritating but also useful. That's really hilarious.
Demanded
that sounds like
an
some shit I would say.
Get your life together. I need an action plan. 12
by
steps.
Wednesday, like for real. Let's have an update. Like that's hilarious. She says, I want to just read the addendums to number 6, which is 6A. Don't be totally rude about truth telling. Consider how much truth is actually needed to get the job done. Finesse goes a long way. And 6B, these conversations are more fun when they're preceded by emphatic girl goes a long way. That's true. Number 7, surround yourself with women you can get sloppy drunk with, who won't draw stupid things on your face if you pass out, and who will help you puke if you over celebrate, and who also will tell you if you get sloppy drunk too much or behave badly when you are sloppy drunk. That's a good one. Number 8, don't flirt, have sex, or engage in emotional affairs with your friends, significant others. This shouldn't need to be said, but it needs to be said. That significant other is an asshole, and you don't want to be involved with an asshole who's used goods. If you want to be with an asshole, get a fresh asshole of your very own. They are abundant.
They're everywhere.
They are every fucking where. Number 9, don't let your friends buy ugly outfits or accessories you don't want to look at when you hang out. This is just common sense, obviously. Number 10, when something is wrong and you need to talk to your friends and they ask you how you are, don't say fine. They know you're lying and it irritates them, and a lot of time is wasted with the back and forth of are you sure and yes and really and I am fine. Tell your lady friends the truth so that you can talk it out and either salt companionably or move on to other topics. 11, if 4 people are dining, and this is one you and I talk about all the time, split the check four even ways. We're adults now. We don't need to add up what each person had anymore. If you're high rolling, just treat everyone and rotate who tweets. If you're still in the broke stage, do what you have to do. I hate that.
And
it offends me.
No, listen, if there's somebody, and I've got individuals in our life now that are unemployed, there's things that, like, I'm not going to ask you to split that. Right. I do the opposite. If I'm high rolling, I'll take care of it. But if someone in our group is I know they can't handle it, I'm not asking to split it 4 ways. I'm certainly not buying like expensive ass shit. But I do really feel like if we're all going out and we're ordering food and you ask to split it and we're not in any of these like financial boats we're talking about, mm-hmm. it's like a bit of a like, oh, what? Like, you don't like that's where we're at as a friend. Like our friendship is such that you're worried about maybe paying $2 more or less. I'm not here for that, mm-hmm. you know? But then the opposite, it's like I would say that can go the other direction too. Like, and I haven't had this experience, but pretend you had a friend that you go out with and every time you go out, split it four ways, like, yeah, we'll take the Dom Perignon and, you know, give me the fucking Opus One. Like, you know, I wouldn't be hanging out with those people very much either.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
And there was one, the be direct and don't be like, I'm fine. I would say like, and this is just me, I have a personal trigger with like, I would call it like not passive aggressive, but just passive aggressive body language. When there's a disconnect between the words, I tend to be a little bit, I can sense, you know, body language and stuff. At least I think I can. I'm attuned to that sort of. So if someone's like, you know, like, oh yeah, no problem, but like their body's like, fuck you. That just, I don't know. I don't do well with that personally, and I think in my life, I find with all relationships, male, female, employer, being direct and having candor, it's just so much better. And with my friends, I really am like, in fact, Unruly Ref, like we're talking and she had something about one of the workshop we're working on and she was trying to be sensitive to me and didn't want, I'm like, listen, let me just tell you, A, that's not an issue. I really appreciate you being concerned about that, but that's not what I'm about. Like, let's put that to bed. And secondarily, please, I'm absolutely prefer candor and directness. It saves so much time. We don't have to, let's take my emotion and my male fragility and take that off the shelf and let's just get this done. And we work so much quicker, you know, and it's kind of nice. And she said the same thing, like, oh, good, I'm the same way and this and that. And like, if you know you're not going to be like hurting somebody, but it's like if I have broccoli in my teeth and you don't fucking tell me and after a bunch of hours, I'm kind of mad about it, you know? And like, if I'm doing something that's like not appropriate or you have an issue with, and you don't tell me for weeks on end, like, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Like, what was our friendship about?
Yeah, what was it about, and what was the point of it?
Yeah. It's true. You know? Like, and my smooth mustache, he and I have had, you know, since we've been living here, really, like, our friendship and our conversations, we had more time to get deeper. And, you know, I came clean. Like, listen, but I almost wrote a letter to you that was like, this is an issue. You know what I mean? And instead of writing the letter, I adjusted my behavior. And I told him straight up, like, there's times that I have to manage my, I don't want to be hurt by you and our friendship knowing how you are. So I don't put myself in those positions. And that's not, you know, but I had the conversation with him. You know what I mean? Like, we're at least friends enough where I can be honest. But like, you are kind of not perfect in this couple of ways. And I do have an issue with it. And I'm not trying to change you, but I'm not putting myself in a position to be bothered by that either. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if you know, but like almost like 9 out of 10 times we do shit, it's like, it almost has to be pretty casual. Come on over if you want, whatever. Don't worry about it. Cause if it's like a time thing, like meet me here at this or that, he's probably going to piss me off. You know what I mean?
True.
And that, I'm not saying that that's like, I shouldn't be mad about that or this, but like, we have a friendship. I'm not ending that friendship. I'm not trying to change him. I care about him unconditionally, but I'm also not going to like hurt myself by being like, you know, and I'm also not going to sit here like fucking passive aggressively, like bemoaning it. Oh, fucking Miss Smoothie Mesh is such a dick and fuck this and fuck that. Like, no, just, okay, that's how he is, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're friends.
And I think that a lot of times, like, that's what has to happen is you have to decide when you're in relationship with people, whether it's friendship or romantic relationship or business relationship, whatever, you know, are you going to accept them where they are or are you not? Like, a lot of times I find so much conflict in personal relationships is like an inability to do that. Like, there's this conditional idea of, well, I'm going to be okay with this person, but here's a bunch of shit that I'm not cool with them doing. And it's like, well, at some point, you know, we all have to be honest about who we are. And that's not saying there isn't room for grace and growth, but there also needs to be a place of like, I'm accepting this person, faults and all, and we're going to work together on all of those things.
Yeah. Grace, growth. And I would even say compromise, you know, cause there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you could say, hey, listen, this or that, like, oh, you know what, you know, this, that isn't how I am. And I see that and it's a problem, but I'll try to do better in this regard. You know what I mean? Like, you just, you know, that's how you do it. And, but if that's a function of the friendship, right? Like, I'm not making compromises and I'm not, you know, eating shit for somebody that's low rung on the friendship. I'll just stop being friends with you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I was trying to get that to Dr. Stash. And he was doing almost the exact opposite. This sort of like having this, like, I don't know, like a petty, like, chart, like a people that have like a list, people that have done me wrong, and like I'm gonna cut this person off and cut them. Like, don't, why even approach it that way? Why not just have friendships and do what you normally do? And what he does is give unconditionally, mm-hmm. and that's where he gets burned.
Yeah,
because he gives. He really does. He gives so much, and then he feels used.
Yeah,
and I was like, well, give unconditionally, but it's not a one way street. And if it's a relationship you want to maintain, you can have conversations or you can put boundaries up. And if it's not, then that's fine.
Then don't. Then exactly. Don't. Exactly.
You know? Speaking of petty.
Oh, I wasn't done with the last two.
Oh, you weren't? Oh.
If a friend sends a crazy email needing reassurance about love, life, family, or work, respond accordingly in a timely manner, even if it's just to say, girl, I hear you. And number 13, my mother's favorite saying is, qui se ressemble s'ensemble. Whenever she didn't approve of whom I was spending time with, she'd say this ominously. It means essentially you are whom you surround yourself with. So there you go. Those are Roxanne's 13 rules for female friendships. And I actually think they should just be rules for friendships.
Yeah, I agree. I think same with the you are who you surround yourself mm-hmm. with. You know.
So we don't have a soundbite for this yet. And people out there, all of you Johnners, please let us know. But we have a new segment.
Tom Petty Chronicles.
Called the Petty Chronicles. Maybe we'll have to. I hate Tom Petty.
So do I. He's so fucking just like whiny. And I won't know people love him. I do. They really do. And it's like, ugh.
Anyway, so we'll be sharing the pettiest news that we come across. And we picked one for this week. So the one I picked was EU's Brexit negotiator demands that all talks are conducted in French. Because that's the official language of the EU. I just thought it was the best. So
like,
petty.
Oh, the EU? Brits?
You know? Oh, yeah. Oui. Like, I just thought it was hilarious.
The Queen's English? You'd like to leave the exit? No, je ne comprends pas.
Exactly.
Oh, parlez-vous français?
Yeah, exactly. So it's really hilarious.
Not that it's related, because it's not, but you know, like, products get more expensive and they don't want to change the price point, so they lower the amount of shit you get. Like a pint of ice cream is no longer a
pint.
Right,
now it's just like smaller. Like, it's like a spoonful now.
Yeah. Exactly. So I guess Swiss or Swedish chocolatier Toblerone, which I've never liked. I just Ferrero Rocher, Toblerone. I don't get that shit. But anyway, Toblerone. And again, I don't eat it. I don't know. But it's a triangular-shaped candy bar that's got like a flat piece on the bottom. And then these triangles have like spaces in between them. So they're like ridges or almost like teeth. Okay. That's how a Toblerone bar looks.
Right.
And you break the little teeth off.
Yeah.
So Toblerone needing.
I thought it was Toblerone. But
Toblerone, Toblerone, whichever. Remember. The chocolate. Needing to adjust their pricing because of the cost of sugar and chocolates and other things.
Yeah.
Rather than make it smaller, which a lot of people do, right?
Yeah.
Which would have been kind of hard. They have an iconic package and sizing and shape, and probably their manufacturing facility boxes it up and shit. So needing to adjust the size of the chocolate inside their iconic sized triangular thing, they increased the space between the ridges, right? So these like chocolate teeth. And they reduced it by a lot. Like, they took like 10 to 15% out. Like, it wasn't just a small amount. It was like, you know, like 40 grams out of a 400 gram bar kind of thing.
Right.
And so there's all these pictures now
of people's Toblerone.
It's Toblerone before the Brexit, after the Brexit. After the Brexit. And like, what the fuck? What the like, fuck where'd all the chocolate go? And it really looks kind of, I think they made a mistake. I think they should have change the size of the, because it just looks silly.
It's it
like,
does.
Like it's so obvious. Like if my pint of ice cream is a bit smaller, I don't really notice.
Right.
If my chocolate bar has a giant space where the chocolate
like,
used to be,
what's going on here?
Like, holy fuck! What happened?
I find that a lot of times, you know, they sell at like Five Below. They have the like 10 for $10 candies, and it's like the box of like, you know, gummies or Mike and Ike's or whatever. And it's like you open the box, there's like a bag in it. The bag is like half full. It's like a joke. It makes it look like it's candy. That's the same size at the movie theater, but it's so like
it's
a
so
quarter
bad.
Of
the,
that.
There's the and I do that 10 for 10 or 4 for, and I've stopped buying in that box the Swedish fish for that very reason, because it'll be a big box and then you open it like, wait, there's a small little bag, there's like 8 Swedish fish in here, the fuck. So I'm a fan of petty parking and parking notes, and in fact as a youth when I first started driving, I had one of these like, what do you call it? Like a series of like a post-it notes, right? Like a pad of paper that was already printed out and written. And it was literally like a thank you note. And it was all sardonic. Like, oh, thank you so much for parking like such a fucking asshole. Because you parked so terribly, nobody else can park in any way. But so someone posted this, and I'll just read it. To whoever owns this car, underlined, my grandmother smoked. My grandfather smoked his entire life. I was about 10 years old when my mother said to him, if you ever want to see your grandchildren graduate, you need to stop smoking immediately. Tears welled up in his eyes when he realized exactly what was at stake. He quit cold turkey that very day. 3 years later, he died of lung cancer. We were very close, and his death destroyed me. My mother said to me, please never smoke. Don't put your family through what your grandfather put us through. I agreed. At 18, I've never touched a cigarette. I must say I feel a very slight sense of regret for never having done that because your parking job was so shitty, it literally gave me cancer anyway. Jesus fuck, please learn to park.
Jesus. Oh my God. That is really, really petty.
It goes on, like the letters, like to handwrite all that. Gosh. I have a tinge of regret because having your parking job literally gave me cancer. It's like, listen. Wow. Like, really? That's petty. That's very petty. That tweet has 140,000 retweets.
Of course it does. Because there's nothing we love more than petty. Of course. So anyways, if you have any suggestions for what song we should use for Petty Chronicles, just hit us up on Twitter. You can just hashtag the John and just say what you think it should be. Or you can email us and all the other things you can do to us as well.
Papa Petty.
So TV, movie, games, whatever. Atlanta's first season ended. I have to say it's probably one of the best first seasons of a show I've seen in decades, like easily. I'm really like, and I'm not a huge, I haven't been a huge Donald Glover fan or non-fan. I just haven't been too into him one way or the other. But this show is really amazing.
He was the one that had the rap song that was like, he transcended whiteness or something, right? Wasn't that him?
Yeah, well, he's Childish Gambino.
Yeah, but so, I should say Childish Gambino.
I don't know if it's Donald himself.
There's his alter ego.
A persona attached to that.
He wrote
that,
but yeah.
Yeah. So the best character on the show, though, is clearly Darius, who I think might be one of the most complex black male characters that has ever been portrayed on television. Like, literally defies all stereotypes you could ever assign to blackness. And I love that about it. And a lot of that is true on the show, but I think for this character in particular just makes me laugh. So they had a couple of quotes from him from the show that were really funny. From episode one, he says, where's that dog with the Texas on him? He says, if you could use a rat as a phone, that'd be genius. There's 5 rats for every 1 person in New York alone. Everybody would have an affordable phone.
Rat phone.
I was just wondering, can I measure your tree? I like Flo Rida. Moms needs to be able to enjoy rap too. Mm-hmm. On prison food, the food here is genetically modified to make you high.
Did grandma's like, they keep me low? That's grandma, right?
No, Flo Rida is Get Low.
I thought that was
apple bottom jeans.
Oh, yeah. But I thought that was, I thought he was, wasn't he also the riding dirt?
That no, him? That's not him. Oh, right. No, that's Chamillionaire.
Oh, you're right.
And I'm mad I know that. Okay. Yes, that's Chamillionaire, just to be sure.
Did we talk about, are you done with Atlanta? I loved it too.
Is Paperboy Atlanta's Tupac? They said no. They said no. Anyway, I just loved the show. I thought it was really genius. So many of the episodes, the Juneteenth episode was brilliant. The one that they did that was the entire BET show.
Yes, BET with the fucking joke.
Brilliant. Commercials. With the commercials in it. The one-off episode they had about the girlfriend.
When him and Paperboy go for the drug deal at the fucking, that character is fucking off the chain
crazy. The whole season. I'm excited for season two. If you haven't seen it, definitely check it out. It's on FX and you can watch on FX now or whatever their fucking go version is as well. I have given up on The Walking Dead, so I don't know what your deal is with it.
Have we tweeted since the season premiere? Have we podcast since the season premiere?
I haven't.
So I tweeted and I don't think I need to talk about it. Plenty of other people have talked about it, but the season premiere and Negan and spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, spoiler alert, Glenn gets fucking killed, but they crossed the line with that for me, you know, and they really, I know a lot of people said the same thing, that it just, the violence went from, and it wasn't the person, it wasn't that it was Glenn, it wasn't that it was humans versus walkers or deads, it was that it felt like violence became this like gimmick, like Jackass. I said this to you, like Jackass, the movies, like I don't really care for them, I don't watch them, but like from number one to number two to number three, it was like, how can we like kick ourselves in the balls harder and make us eat shit and farts more? Like the race to the bottom was like, not anywhere I need to go. Like, it's just like lowest common denominator, really bad. And I feel like they did that with Glenn's death. Like, I don't know why it needed to be like that, why Negan needed to be like mocking him. The, like, they showed it so many times. It's fucking like eyeball and shit. It just, it, I mean, I screamed. It was like, it just was too much.
Right.
And so I don't know if that's a jumping the shark moment for them, that there's like, okay, your show now is really just this gratuitous who can show the most gross violence. And maybe the graphic novels I've heard took a similar turn.
Yeah, a friend of mine was telling me they stopped reading also when Negan was introduced in the comics because it just took, it went a similar way. And I mean, I'm sure it's appealing to some people. I'm just saying it's not appealing to me. And
I don't think it's appealing to the fan base that they've built.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think their ratings are going to suffer. So I don't necessarily agree with that. Well, I don't.
So I watched the next episode and it wasn't about Negan at all. It was like Morgan and Carol,
right.
And I thought that was good. I liked it. That was done well. I thought the Ezekiel character I liked a lot. So I'll keep watching it, but I've got it on a short leash.
Yeah.
Because I drop shows all the time.
It definitely stopped being like must-see for me. So if I catch it, I might catch it at some point, but whatever.
So I did want to read this. A newspaper printed an obituary for Glenn.
Oh, dude.
Yeah. That's so funny. Glenn Rhee, husband, father-to-be, warrior and friend, departed from this world October 23rd. He was 32. Born and raised in Michigan to Korean immigrant parents, he settled in Atlanta to undertake his career of delivering pizzas and brightening the world around him until the unthinkable happened, the Walker apocalypse. It was then that the real Glenn emerged, a man of impeccable moral grounding and logistical wizardry. A faithful friend, Glenn spared no personal risk or inconvenience to care for and provide for his adopted apocalyptic family of survivors. His bravery in the face of both the undead and the brutal living inspired all who knew him. He exhibited top-notch leadership when his leader and mentor was either unavailable or unable to lead. His commitment to moral principles in a world gone mad breathed hope and promise into those around him who meant him no harm. He is survived in death by his loving wife Maggie and their unborn child, Rick, Carol, and Judith Grimes, Carol Peltier, Daryl Dixon, the warrior woman known only as Michonne, and various other adoptive family members and associates that will likely be more memorable in their eventual deaths than they ever were in life. In lieu of flowers and family, and ask donations to the literally anyone who can help them defeat Negan be made in his memory. Someone took that out of the fucking obituary. Kudos to that newspaper. But yeah, I'm not done with Walking Dead, but I'm not loving it either.
Yeah, it just is what it is. So we watched X-Men Apocalypse, and I have to take full responsibility for the shit show that occurred in us watching it, because I watched it on a plane. Well, let me correct that. I watched half of it on a plane, and I came back and I said, you know, Drew, it was weird. I only got to see half the movie, but it was pretty good. I actually wanted to see what happened, so we should watch it, because I thought the first half was good, and how bad could the second half get?
Pretty bad.
Cut to the worst second half of a movie ever. So that movie sucked.
It's not that it sucked.
It did.
It had so many like critical weird things. Like, A, it was 2 hours and 40 minutes. Like, that's just that was way long. It was boring at points. B, it felt like the first half of the movie was one director and the second half was another. The first half felt like rehashing of origin stories, and then the second was like just the one main character's bit. I don't know. There was a bunch of fight scenes that I didn't think were really good. Even the CGI towards some of the end was like, what the fuck? This looks terrible. It was convoluted and weird, and I can see why people were bummed about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was not good.
You know, you don't have it on the list, but can we talk a little bit about the new Ghostbusters?
We can, sure.
And I'm not, and this is, you know, there's always this sort of conflating of critique and opinion, in particular with the new Ghostbusters, about it being women, right? All the shit Leslie kind of went through. So I'm hoping I'm not biased in that regard at all, but I think just as a product standing on its own, I didn't think it was all that great. I don't know why they went like a half version of it was like a, you know, there's like reimagining, right? Where they kind of reimagine the thing. And then there's a complete, like, we're going to just redo it almost like line for line, but with like a modern flavor twist. They went like somewhere in between. And I don't know. I found it a little bit almost slow, but maybe that's just me. I'm, you know me, I'm a pretty Like I shit on a lot of movies. Like yeah. I expect
your expectations of movies are like ridiculous. I literally, my expectation is, was it an okay time to spend my 2 hours? Then I'm okay with it. You are like, if it didn't blow you away and make you want to like reevaluate your entire life, fuck that movie.
Yeah, and I'm like I said, I'm not saying that the new Ghostbusters was bad. That's not it at all. I just
didn't know the point of it. That's how I felt about it. Like, truthfully, like, I was mad I spent the whole 2 hours watching it because it did absolutely nothing. Like, I just didn't even know.
But that's what I mean by it. It's halfway between redoing the whole movie.
Right.
And I can't think of an example where that's been done, but I know that they do that. Where, like, there was a 1950 fucking version and now it's like a 1970 version. Like, you can do that. They didn't do that. And then there's, like, a complete, like, it's a retelling, but in a completely different way, like Dirty Dancing Havana Nights, right? You know, you can do kind of different things. And they didn't do that either. It was sort of like they took the basic plot and premise, modernized it to a 2016, and then made some like kind of like fundamental different changes.
Right.
I don't know. And really, this is kind of like, I don't want to say like my least favorite arc or person was the male receptionist. What's his name? Is that
Chris Hemsworth?
Thor. Yeah, and I don't think that he did a particularly bad job.
What was the point?
Yeah, like I said,
I guess because they had a female receptionist in the first one,
but they didn't. She didn't have a huge role.
She had a pretty big role because she was with Rick Moranis, and there was that whole subplot of that.
Yeah, but not nearly as big a role as what's his name had in this one.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe not.
Jenny's
right.
role was pretty big.
She had a big role.
It was
You're
pretty
right.
big. I mean.
I don't know. It just fell a little bit flat for
me. Yeah. So one thing I did watch, I watched a couple of things while I was away in New Orleans with the Blue Crew. Shout out to all of them. I had a great time in New Orleans. I did some amazing work together. The Serena doc, which is on Netflix right now, is just called Serena, and it's a documentary about Serena, generally speaking, and also about the last the most recent run she tried to do the Grand Slam, which she didn't actually win the last one, but whatever. Fascinating,
the one I made you watch.
Yeah. Fascinating documentary. Really, really good stuff. Serena's fucking amazing, and you get to see her ass in so many wonderful, glorious ways, including twerking. So I'm just going to mention that because I'm here for Serena twerking all the time. Also, new show on Netflix that I don't think you've seen is called Chewing Gum. It's a British show with a young woman, black woman named Michaela Cole. And it's really funny. It's about a 24-year-old British black woman who is a virgin and very religious. And she decides that she doesn't want to be a virgin anymore. She ends up with a white boyfriend, and I've only gotten like 2 episodes in, but I think it's hilarious. Some people find it like it's kind of cringe humor, so there's a little bit of like you know how The Office was like, what's that called? Where it's like,
not Schadenfreude, but I hear what you mean, like awkward,
yeah, uncomfortable, like that kind of thing. But I think it's really funny. Her face is amazing; just she makes all these really great faces, and she's super awkward, and I just think it's really funny. And also, I got the pleasure of making my podcast fandom debut with Phenom Black and, of course, the amazing author Nina Perez, where we reviewed episode 8 of Queen Sugar. Which was the hurricane episode. And I really enjoyed doing that and just was awesome and had a great time.
Have we shouted out loosely exactly Nicole on this podcast show?
I don't know if we have, but go ahead. Let's praise her because that show is so fucking hilarious.
MTV?
It's on VH1, I believe.
Okay, so if you all have not, do yourself a favor and go watch Loosely Exactly Nicole. I bet you can get it on demand. I think it is VH1. It is, I don't want to say I'm not even going to bother describing it. It's about as, it's different in a way that is so deliciously entertaining. And she, the main character, whose name is actually Nicole, is, I feel like she's like, you know how they give comedians TV shows and there's like, it used to be like, everyone loves Raymond. And then there was like Seinfeld. Like there was like, it was kind of like Seinfeld, but not really. This is in that same vein where like, I think she's a comedian or an actress and they've given her a show, but I feel like it's more her and improv. And it just, I fucking love it. And her fucking gay roommate is the fucking bee.
Oh my God, he's so hilarious. And funnily Holy enough, the best shit. Thing about that guy, we knew that guy.
Yeah. So we Not used the to know, actor.
No, but we used to know this guy named Kyle, who is that dude. Yeah. Like, to a T. Looks like him, acts like him, says phrases like him. Everything. It's really disturbing.
Yeah.
Every episode, I'm like, Kyle did that. Like, dead ass.
Yeah, but Loosely Exacting Nicole is
really funny.
Terrific. Yeah. Just terrific. And Blunt Talk is back on Showtime. And that's a good show. Picard. What's that guy's name?
Which guy?
Blunt Talk.
Oh,
Patrick Stewart. And that's very good.
Yeah, that's a good show.
His too. Man Friday cracks me up.
Yeah, that's very funny. What else? We got stuff to promote. Oh, we did guesting on Reminiscing with Chris this weekend, where we hashed out Beetlejuice among lots of other things. So if you're a premium subscriber to Movie Trailer Reviews, which you should be, Movie Trailer Reviews Network, you can check that out. And we have a guest coming up at the end of this month, November 30th. Our boy Ricky.
I haven't spoken to Ricky in so long.
From America's United again. He's going to be on the show at the end of the month, and I'm excited for that, so be on the lookout for that. What else? Well, you know, it's a big week for us this week.
Yeah, we got our holidays coming up. Big anniversary.
Our 15th anniversary is coming up. How are you feeling about this milestone?
It's weird. In some ways, like 15 years is like, fuck, that's a long time.
Right.
And then I'm like, well, it doesn't feel like a long time.
Right.
And then you start going back over the years, like, wow, we've done a lot of things. It has been a long time.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be TMI, and you might have to maybe like erase this after the fact, but you know, it's been a hard year for us personally. And
it has been, definitely.
It's been taxing on our marriage. Yeah. I'll just be honest. And you know, we've made the decision to have some couple counseling. I don't say that embarrassingly, you know. Expert help is always good, yes, especially
I'm
after
if
you're
going to
get 15 years.
Therapy is great.
Might need a hand, and I would say, just us, where I feel about us and our marriage, and you know, there's ups and downs, and you know, things aren't perfect. But I was looking at this date on the calendar, the anniversary, and this trip, and I felt. I was worried. I really was. I felt like we were in a place like, man, I just, you know, these trips and vacations, it can bring you together or push you apart.
Yeah.
Right? It can do a couple of different things. And I wasn't feeling where we were and just the amount of time we had to get where I wanted to be because you were traveling so much and everything was going on. But that was maybe like a couple of months ago. And I feel that, and thank you. You've been working really hard. And I do say you because, you know, you work, the work you do takes a lot out of you. You know, I don't think most people know it's not just the hours and the time, but like, that's not like, you know, just going and like doing something mindless like that. That's work that is draining emotionally and physically. And, you know, you have to decompress from that and, you know, it's a lot. So, I thank you for putting in the time, and committing to time for us. It's meant a lot. And I feel really, great about our anniversary. I feel better about this trip and coming forward, and I can't wait. I feel thrilled, and I'm just so lucky to be married to you and have you in my life. And you know, I said to my therapist the other day, I called you my best friend, and he's like, "Oh, okay, that makes a lot more." Like something clicked for him. Like that didn't. Like, and I didn't know maybe that was like unusual, but he didn't. He doesn't refer to his partner as his best friend.
Well, I don't think everybody has relationships like that. And I don't think everybody needs it either. I think some people are different. That's not us. I think we are very like.
Yeah, I find myself very fortunate to have married my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
But just as much as I was talking about having issues with my other BFF, Dr. Stash, you know, things aren't perfect. And I guess I don't want to be TMI, but I'm feeling very good. How are you feeling?
I'm, you know, the milestone is a great one. I think, you know, we've done a big thing in just celebrating, especially every 5 years, just making a you know, milestone, you know, markers for us and our marriage. And I think that looking back on the last 5 years and where we are now than where we were, you know, 10, I think we've both had a lot of personal growth over this 5 years. And so that, I think, has been part of some of the strain is each of us kind of finding our own way and dealing with our own, you know, just the part of getting older. You know, we both turned 40 in those 5 years. And so a lot of that I feel. And then the other thing that's something that we've been talking about in therapy a lot is, you know, that we deliberately decided not to have children. One of the reasons why when we discussed not having kids was that we really treasured our relationship and how important it was to us and how we recognized that having children inherently is going to change the relationship of the parents. And then this movement happened and inadvertently I had a baby and nobody acknowledged that fact. We didn't to each other. And so that was interesting.
Yeah, I've used that analogy for a while now, that the movement is your baby and I can't, you know, it's not my baby. I can support and love the baby and help you with the baby, but we didn't talk about having a baby. We didn't plan on having a baby. Right. As much as like, you know, not a bad thing, but like, you know, when people have a baby, there's like, you know, what to expect when you're expecting.
Right. And you have, you know, 9 months of plan. Yeah. It doesn't just like pop up in your life as a full grown ass person that needs feeding and eating and all of those things.
Conversations that I wouldn't say we didn't have, but like, you know, just practically speaking, how are we going to do this? And what are the boundaries? And what's this? It just sort of like we jumped into it. And that, you know, that's kind of how people have babies sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
It's a way to have a baby.
It's not probably the best way.
That's how Rachel Dratch had her baby.
That is how Rachel. God, shout out to you, Rachel Dratch.
God love her. God love her.
Yeah. So, yeah. So anyways, I was just saying that, you know, I think that that's been, I think, a learning curve for us both over the last 2 years. And for me, you know, when you say like you're thankful to me, like I don't think you need to be thankful to me. But one of the things that I've been kind of just like coming to terms with myself is like understanding what that means and like really thinking about my decision differently and, you know, understanding that. Legitimately, I can't continue. I couldn't continue at the pace I was this last, you know, year and a half to 2 years. And
I mean,
live my life, much less continue having a successful marriage.
Yeah, so. That's what I mean. If we're getting really real, and I sometimes don't want to talk too much about our personal life, but and that's kind of what got us to therapy was that the pace and the work that you were doing. You know, I had to come to terms with this is not. Tenable for me, you know, and that's hard. That was not a, and I'm not saying like, oh, woe is me, but like, there's a little bit of a, you know, I'm beyond reticent. I'm unwilling to sit here and be like, you know, oh, you know, pay attention to me. I'm your husband and I need your time. When like you're doing like Black liberation work is very important. You know what I mean? Like if you were like, I don't know, fucking around doing like bullshit, it'd be a different story.
Right.
You know, I'd be like, no, fucking
and I think
pay
that there's like a unique thing about you, like you being a white man in a relationship with a Black woman and like you being like, hey.
I don't address that with you, but that's absolutely a part of it. You know, like there's, you know, I seek to model appropriate behavior as to how to be anti-racist and white.
Right.
And, you know, what fucking worse way were there to be like, you know, fuck your liberation and pay attention to me, damn it. Like, that's not exactly the, like, you know.
And yet, you know, we are in a committed long-term relationship with each other, so.
And it, you know, that's, it's weird. And it's, I think it's like a microcosm of the, like, the concept that we are perhaps trying to take down systems of oppression and supremacy and, you know, take it a little bit meta, almost like capitalism, right? But at the same time, still needing to live and breathe and be a part of those systems. Like, it's like, how do you destroy the house that you're living in and need as a roof over your head, right? And, you know, in our, I'll say a microcosm, that's sort of like the same kind of in our marriage, you know, like what we're trying to do isn't exactly conducive time-wise to, you know what I mean?
Oh, Lord. Something just popped up and said that my actual handle is trending in Seattle on Twitter right now.
Your handle is trending in Seattle? Why would that be?
Because of the Susan B. Anthony thread I did this morning. I kind of went off. It's gone.
Well, let's.
Somebody made a moments about it.
Let's keep the podcast going because I got other stuff to get to today.
Anyways, I am very excited to celebrate our 15th anniversary and our 18 years together. I'm very excited because I know how much of a deep commitment this has meant for both of us and how how special our partnership is and continues to be. And I just can't wait for the next 15 years. And so I love you so very much, and happy anniversary. And
oh, I love you too,
I can't
man.
Wait to celebrate together.
You know, I won't give you all, so we're going to have a moment. We're going to give a speech and stuff.
Yeah.
But,
I told you cannot make me cry. Remember?
Oh, I'm going to make you cry.
See, this is the kind of shit I'm talking about. Cry. I'm going to have mascara on.
Well, too bad.
I guess I won't wear mascara then.
Yeah, Pandocita.
Pandocita.
Well, I'll give you a tease. Mm-hmm. I'll give the podcast listener a tease. Do you remember when I proposed, like for real with friends and family on our anniversary?
I remember.
Do you remember what I said?
I remember something about the person that I was going to become.
Do you remember specifically the "Will you marry me?" phrase I used?
Will I do you the honor of... I don't remember it.
Will you do the honor of letting me love you the rest of our lives?
Mm.
And it has been an honor. And I look forward to loving you more and more and more.
Now you're going to make me cry here, babe.
Aw, I love you.
I love you too.
I guess.
Just try to get it out before you start bursting into
tears. Please do.
Good night, everybody.
High five.